You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week John Lannon, who is a member of the Executive Committee of PANA, Peace and Neutrality Alliance in Ireland, a founding member of Shannon Watch, a lecturer and researcher at the University of Limerick, where he is part of the Human Rights and Development Research Cluster, Development Practice Research Cluster. He is working with an organization for democracy in the Congo. He is working with another organization called DORAS, D-O-R-A-S, on helping refugees and asylum seekers in Europe. John Lannon, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be with you, David.
Great to have you on. Too much probably to talk about. We can try to cover many of the things you're working on, but maybe we could start with Shannon Airport and neutrality in Ireland. Where do things stand now?
Yeah, this is something that has been occupying my mind for the last while here, and also occupying a lot of my Sundays as we engage in peaceful protest outside Shannon Airport. Ireland claims to be a neutral country. And I guess if we went back to the foundation of the state and the guy, Eamon de Valera, who drafted our constitution, it was probably so implicit or understood at that time that he didn't bother putting it in our constitution. But it has always been practiced that we would be neutral. However, the definition of what we determine as neutrality has shifted over the years. And now our governments tend to refer to something called military neutrality, which doesn't really exist in international law, but they use it to mean that we don't engage directly in military alliances. Now, the problem is that while they say that, they have also been supporting the transit of around 3 million U.S. troops and their weapons through our small civilian airport on the west coast of Ireland. That's Shannon Airport. And that has been happening since 2002, when the government essentially gave the use of the airport to the U.S. military and the logistics folks to help first with the invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq. It was intended to be a temporary measure, but here we are in 2019 and it's still going on.
It seems like an incredible contradiction. I mean, I could imagine Ireland saying to the United States, no, you cannot bring your troops through our airports anymore. Why not? Well, because we don't engage directly in military alliances. I mean, it seems like a perfect explanation for the opposite policy of what's being engaged in.
Not only would it be perfectly logical and in line with the intent at least of the Constitution, which says that we do endeavor for peaceful resolution of conflict, but it would also be in line with the views of the majority of Irish people who do support proper neutrality and are opposed to the U.S. military use of Shannon. Well, actually, perhaps I should correct that to say if they were aware of the extent of the U.S. military use of Shannon Airport, they would be opposed. As Shannon Watch and Peace and Neutrality Alliance, and we have a number of other groups here in Ireland who are constantly highlighting this, trying to bring it to the public's attention, but the mainstream media are by and large quite silent on the matter. So if you look, for example, at the website, if you look at the media, if you look at the promotional material as well from the airport, from all of the information flows relating to any aspect of activity in Shannon Airport, you will see absolutely no mention of the U.S. military, even though there are 2-3 military or military contracted flights a day landing at the airport.
This not engaging in military alliances sounds like such a wonderful idea to me, because here in the United States, when one speaks against the NATO military alliance these days, one is immediately denounced as not only a lover and worshiper of Donald Trump, but a servant and slave and tool of the evil, aggressive intentions of Vladimir Putin. I wonder how one manages in Ireland to be an engaged international, global citizen without supporting NATO. I mean, to be a good, civilized, liberal member of society these days in the United States, one must absolutely adore NATO.
Yeah, NATO is presented, broadly speaking, as a benign entity that engages in activities relating to peace and humanitarianism, broadly speaking, here in Ireland. Our main government party of the moment, Fine Gael, would probably have us in NATO if they had their way and if they were able to, and if it wasn't for some of us who are resisting that. I guess many Irish people possibly wouldn't even know if we were members of NATO or not. Such is the discourse around our proximity to NATO. Of course, we have another issue at the moment, which we might get on to speaking to as well, that the plans to strengthen the European Union security and defence it's perhaps a counterbalance to NATO. Also, I guess, seen as by the stronger European countries as attempting to reduce the European Union's reliance on NATO. And this is something that we in Ireland are getting sucked into inexorably as well and are becoming part of.
It's not clear to me that conversation has really taken hold in the United States, where some of us are aware that Trump is demanding that France and Germany support NATO and stop all this crazy evil talk of a European military. But everybody in the U.S. public is of the belief that Trump is trying to destroy NATO, and therefore NATO is a force for good. What are people aware of in Europe, and what are they, when offered the choice of NATO or a European military or peaceful foreign relations, what do they prefer?
It's an interesting question. We actually had a politician here in Ireland close to 20 years ago. Mary Harney was her name. She was in government, and she once made a comment to the effect that we were sometimes closer to Boston than Berlin, you know, drawing on the large Irish contingent, I guess, that exists in
sure.
Boston. Ireland sort of keeps its options open, I think, at all times. Will it sell itself to any empire, any imperialist power? We've, I guess, supported the U.S. And I think, it was misguided on so many levels. Most importantly, the catastrophic damage that is being done by the U.S. military around the world. But we probably hooked ourselves to that empire back at the start of the last decade because we felt that it would be beneficial in terms of trade relations. We've always, for the last several decades, have been relatively close to NATO. We've had fractured relationship, of course, with our nearest neighbor, Britain, and that continues now with Brexit, and of course that preoccupies a lot of the media here now as well as to whether Britain is or not going to leave the European Union. And if Britain leaves the European Union, well, what's going to happen to us? We're still part of it, but we've got a lot of trade links with Britain. So A lot of our thought processes come back to those trade relations. Looking at the EU, which used to be the European Economic Community, this is also something that Ireland benefited quite well from over the decades. Since we joined at the start of the 1970s, there has been fairly welcome and effective support for agriculture. And I think we tend to see the European Union, broadly speaking, as an entity that can be beneficial for us. So we're shifting ourselves towards that. One of the problems is, first of all, the centralization of power in the European Union and the removal of any decision-making and of autonomy for the member states. But another grave difficulty with the European Union now, as I mentioned, is its increasing levels of militarization and its, its views on itself, or when I say its views on itself, I primarily mean France and Germany, their views on their power around the world or their potential power as a European Union entity that has a strong industrial program and military industrial program to back it.
And if the European Union becomes a military alliance and Ireland is in the European Union, then Ireland is in another military alliance, right?
Yes, and we are already, actually, because we've joined a thing called the Permanent Structured Cooperation on Security and Defence, which is part of the European Union. It's known as PESCO for short. This is something that has essentially is embedding us in the European militarization, because this defence cooperation, which, as I said, is possibly intended to reduce the EU's reliance on NATO, is made up of 25 member states, most but not all of which are members of NATO. And it does appear to be paving the way for the creation of a European army. And that is something that's gravely worrying. At the moment, we have been told by our leaders here in Ireland that we will not opt into projects that undermine our military neutrality. But the sort of things that come under PESCO are things like a European or pan-European military training center. They're looking at medical units and logistics hubs that are being led very often by Germany, faster crisis response forces, intelligence exchanges and cyber threats. That's a big one as well. But then you start getting into the areas of things like submarine drones, and you get into the policing of the Mediterranean, essentially forcing migrants who are fleeing from the wars and the catastrophic damages we've done to climate towards Europe, being forced back into Africa. And that border is being militarized now as well, or has been. So, yes, we're being, there's over the last many years, there has been a steady, stealthy normalization of all of this militarization, and that's seeping into our psyche, and there are some of us that are pushing back against the tide, but it's not easy.
We're speaking with John Lennon, who is a founding member of Shannon Watch and a lecturer and researcher at the University of Limerick. John, what do you find with your students and with young people in Ireland in terms of the normalization of militarism? Are they resisting this? Are young people still the place to turn for peace activists?
Not really, unfortunately. And one of the features of our movements, like the Peace and Neutrality Alliance, is the aging profile of a lot of the members. Students, I think, in Ireland got very detached from issues of social justice in general over the last two decades. There is a welcome resurgence in interest in the types of things that students should be concerned about in terms of the issues that affect them. And we've had a number of cases here in Ireland where we had referendums, first of all, in relation to marriage equality and extending the right to marriage to gay couples. But also we've had one on the issue of abortion as well, and the right to abortion. And young people have begun to become exercised on issues like that because, I believe, they can see the connection, how it impacts and how it affects them and their lives. Unfortunately, the devastating consequences of the wars that we're supporting are, of course, also having an impact on their lives, but that connection has not been made yet. So we haven't yet seen the mobilization of young people to oppose things like the U.S. military use of Shannon and our support for wars and our engagement in military alliances. There is more on the other side in terms of supporting people who are fleeing from wars. But again, the rhetoric is garbled often on that, and there are right-wing elements that are disturbing and are instilling fear and ignorance and confusion very often, even in young, educated people who should be paying attention to these matters and taking a more principled stand.
Ireland is taking some positive steps regarding the environment, correct, including divestment from fossil fuels?
Yes, and this is something that we've had a positive engagement with. Our natural resources is something that has exercised us over the years. So I'm thinking in particular around ongoing opposition and non-violent direct action that was taken against essentially a corporate takeover of some of our oil and gas resources off the west coast of Ireland, and the Corrib gas fields, which a previous government essentially sold off to Shell and a number of other large corporations.
And divestment.
Issues related to our, I'm sorry?
Sorry, I was going to ask also, divestment from Israel is something that's made some progress, right?
Yes, it has. And we have become exercised with that. I was going to say, in terms of our fossil fuels, yes, we have. Our peat bogs have always been important to the people of Ireland. And I think we, you know, because we've been an agricultural island and a lot of our people are still rooted in the land and in the farms, they understand the importance of maintaining the integrity of the land and the soil upon which we must live and we must survive. There has also been a long-standing relationship or support for the Palestinian people here in Ireland as well. And that has gone back over the decades. And the most welcome recent manifestation of that, of course, has been the support in our parliament and the passing of a bill to essentially not to boycott and to divest and to not trade in goods coming from the illegal settlements that Israel has placed on the occupied Palestinian territories.
And where I imagine people's understanding falls short is in terms of the connection between these issues, the environmental damage of militarism and the insanity of using militarism as a response to climate change and movement of refugees, the vicious cycle created.
Yes. And we haven't joined the dots there yet because, we don't have enough discussion and discourse about this. We don't have those clear and, you know, to our mind, what should be obvious links between the catastrophic effects of what we in the West are doing or imposing in other parts of the world, and the consequences for us then in terms of the arrival of refugees, the damage to our climate and to the changes there, the difficulties with getting access to water and to food, you know, and terrorism as well. You know, the fact that because we engage in sending armies or supporting armies on their way to creating havoc in cities and communities and families, we get the violent reactions and responses in our own communities as well. Now, thankfully, that's not something that Ireland has been subjected to, but we always worry that there is the potential for that in some places like Shannon Airport.
Yeah. I guess it was back in November that I was in Dublin for a conference with people from various countries wanting to work on closing bases. And I found that valuable in terms of sharing ideas with people from different places. Was that conference helpful to people in Ireland? And what activism is happening these days around Shannon?
That conference was really helpful, and it was a very welcome opportunity for us to engage with like-minded activists from all around the world. Many of our friends and colleagues like yourself from the US, but from other parts of the globe, parts that are affected by US militarism in particular, because we were focusing on US military bases. And I think we're taking more positive steps in the right direction in terms of engaging together and working together to try to hold back this increasingly dangerous juggernaut that's traveling around the world, this military might that's becoming pervasive. It's something, and it's touching all of our lives, because as somebody, as you said, that you mentioned that I work in the university, as somebody who sees what's happening in the science and engineering labs and in other parts and looks at the types of materials and the types of technologies that we're developing, I'm acutely aware as well that a lot of these are going into military applications. And our economy is becoming increasingly dependent on militarism, because our leaders, sadly the ones that we elect, but these are our leaders, are utterly unimaginative when it comes to doing anything else, anything more sustainable in terms of creating an economy and, more importantly, a society that will support us all.
Speaking of unimaginative, I think I've told you, I asked the Irish ambassador to the United States when she visited the University of Virginia how it could be legal for Ireland to allow all these troops to pass through its airports on the way to wars and still claim to be neutral. And she assured me that she had asked members of the U.S. government at the highest level, which I took to mean Donald Trump or some of his gang, and they had assured her it was all perfectly legal. So not only no imagination, no thought at all.
It's all right then, isn't it?
Yeah, just taking orders.
The old adage, they hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, is very much to the fore with all of this. Our government have, and our departmental officials have, consistently and repeatedly told us in response to freedom of information requests and parliamentary questions that they have had assurances as well. So when we had CIA rendition planes coming through Shannon, we were assured that there were no prisoners on board those. with the military planes that were coming through, we were being assured that there are no weapons on board. In fact, we were assured that the troop carriers had no weapons on board until somebody took one of the weapons off one of those planes and presented it, and they could no longer say that there were no weapons on board, so they had to correct that one. But bizarrely, even though the military contracted troop carriers that are passing through Shannon are now said to be and are carrying weapons, the military planes themselves, the ones operated by the US Navy and the US military and Air Force, are not carrying weapons, according to the assurances that have been given. They're not engaged in military exercises or operations. We therefore ask the question, if that's so, then what are they doing? And we have never got an answer to that question.
It's a very good question. What all these militaries do that's non-military, because this comes up all the time with, you know, the financial cost of the wars, and it's a little fraction of the military spending, and you wonder, what is all the other military spending for? It's just for normal maintenance of a war machine, but somehow that's not for wars. People can go, I should mention, to worldbeyondwar.org/Ireland and find a petition telling Ireland to get U.S. troops out of its airports. We'll put up links at Talk Nation Radio to PANA, the Peace and Neutrality Alliance, and to Shannon Watch. I'm hopeful that we can do some big events in the area of Shannon Airport in the coming months and years. What we've got just a minute or two left. What else can people do to help who want to learn more or get involved?
Well, as you say, you can go to our website, so pana.ie. We have shannonwatch.org as well, which has lots of information and ongoing monitoring, essentially, of what's going through Shannon. We have monthly peaceful protests at the airport. I think the more pressure that can be brought and the more questions that can be asked of the Irish government in relation to Shannon Airport, the better. And to looking at what our constitution says in terms of the peaceful resolutions of conflict, and ask, how can any Irish government justify the millions of armed US troops that are coming through one of our airports if they are intent on peaceful resolution? So I think we've through our networks, through our diaspora, through communities, be they Irish, be they other communities, putting those questions, asking, how can a country that claims to be neutral stand over what it's doing in terms of the war and the devastation that it's supporting around the world? That's important.
Very good question. We've been speaking with John Lannan. He is, among other things, a founding member of Shannon Watch. John, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media aren't in the business of challenging the idea that corporations are benevolent social actors who bring benefits to the communities lucky enough to have them. So even if Amazon didn't own a major newspaper, there was no reason to expect much by way of deep media criticism of the company's search for a second HQ, even as that led to cash-strapped U.S. cities falling over one another to offer tax breaks and subsidies to a corporation that paid zero federal taxes last year on profits of over $11 billion. Surprisingly, some media followed the lead of community organizers and questioned the deal, questions Amazon pulled out rather than engage. More surprisingly, the deal's end didn't end the questions. We'll hear that story from journalist Neil DeMoss, author of, most recently, The Brooklyn Wars. Also on the show, we may wish and work for a world in which countries don't have to rely on aid from the United States to fund critical social programs. But while the U.S. is a global aid provider, we're right to examine how that aid is employed. Does it build up or weaken, support or coerce? When it comes to global health funding, recent Republican presidents, but especially Donald Trump, have used aid to restrict women's health care and even the discussion of it, with effects that are as harmful as they are predictable. We'll talk about the fight back to that problem with Nina Besser-Dorley, Senior Program Officer in U.S. Foreign Policy at the International Women's Health Coalition. All of that's coming up this week on Counterspin. By the time Amazon chose New York and Virginia for its second headquarters in November, a funny thing had happened. People had been heard to question not just the value to a community of hosting an anti-union corporation known for worker exploitation and hawking facial recognition software to ICE, but the whole idea of cities competing with one another to attract companies with huge bundles of tax breaks and subsidies. In New York's case, a reported $3 billion worth. When Amazon abruptly pulled the deal off the table on February 14th, there were the anticipated grumbles about anti-corporate activists spoiling what would have been a great opportunity for jobs and growth and all things good. But there were also cheers, not only for standing up to Amazon's particular demands, but for challenging the idea of tax incentives and subsidies as a way to grow or govern healthy communities. Our next guest has been reporting these issues for years. Journalist Neil DeMoss reports for Gothamist. His most recent book is The Brooklyn Wars, but he's also co-author with Joanna Kagan of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. He joins us now by phone from San Francisco. Welcome back to Counterspin, Neil DeMoss.
Always a pleasure.
Well, we spoke about this in October of 2017 in the thick of the choose us unseemliness. It's been interesting, I think, to see the conversation kind of mature, because for many people, it wasn't whether the Amazon deal was the worst as these things go, but whether as these things go is some immutable model whose benefits aren't to be questioned. Well, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo gave the boilerplate argument, you know, the thing that's supposed to make you say, duh, you know, of course it's a good idea for New Yorkers to give billions of dollars in subsidies to a company because it's just simple math. You addressed that line in a Gothamist piece a few months back. What was Cuomo arguing and what's wrong with it?
I think when Amazon announced the DC suburbs and New York City as the two winners of its HQ2, although as a lot of people have pointed out, it's not really a headquarters if there's three of them. But the response in New York was not uniformly excited for a bunch of reasons, partly because of the $3 billion in tax breaks that were involved, and partly because they were talking about going into a neighborhood, Long Island City, that already is beset by overdevelopment and gentrification. And, you know, a lot of people were concerned about the impact on housing prices and things like that. And Governor Cuomo's response was to, as is kind of his style, to get a little huffy about it and to say, no, we're not giving Amazon $3 billion because they'll be paying $30 billion in taxes over the years. So really, it's like we're earning a 900% profit. And this was a very, very odd argument, which is what I tried to address in my Gothamist piece, because normally you don't think of people paying their taxes as a profit for cities, right? You know, people paying their taxes is just what they do in order to help contribute to all the things that keep a city running. So, you know, if Amazon was going to be paying $30 billion in taxes over the years, that's what you need in order to have trains to get the Amazon employees to work and schools for the Amazon employees' kids to go to and, you know, all the other things that city and state governments provide. But suddenly there was this idea of somehow if you are giving someone a 10% tax break, that's really a 90% profit.
It still is said in the Daily News editorial, they basically said that that line makes a lot of sense and people were silly not to understand it. Basically, they didn't get what was going on here. And that also seems to be at work in the very idea that, you know, like it or not, this is the way you get companies to come to your community, you know, whether or not it really breaks down as a benefit, you know, completely in the ledger, still you want these companies to locate, you have to offer these subsidies. And there's questions to be asked about that, aren't there?
Sure. I mean, I think when you look at this whole Amazon sweepstakes, right, they got much bigger offers from a bunch of other states. New Jersey offered, I think, $7 billion. Maryland was, I think, a little bit more than that. And they turned them down because clearly they wanted to be in New York and Washington, D.C., which on the one hand, sure, it's great that New York only offered $3 billion instead of $8 billion. But on the other hand, did they even need to offer that, right? And, you know, it's how much are you leaving on the table by offering huge tax breaks to anybody who, you know, is willing to locate here? A lot of people pointed out that Google is right, opening a new, not headquarters, but larger facility, you know, adding a whole bunch of jobs and not asking for these levels of subsidies. And for another Gothamist article I recently researched, that not long ago they did an investigation of one of these tax breaks, you know, for companies relocating to New York City, and found, I think it was about, they calculated about in 3/4 of the cases, the company would have relocated anyway because it was already profitable and the subsidy was just icing on the cake.
And then if the idea is you want jobs or you want economic growth, there are also other ways that you could do that. You know, if the question is just how can we increase revenue, if that's the bottom line.
Absolutely. You know, and there's been a lot of criticism of people who've said like, oh, we should take the $3 billion and spend it on transit or schools or something like that, because it's not $3 billion we're going to have, right? Because it's just a tax break. So therefore, it's different kind of money you're giving away than if you were taking it out of the state or city treasury. But really, it's the same thing. I mean, you can make a great argument that improved schools or improved transit is an economic investment in the same way that bringing Amazon to New York City is, because if you have better schools, more companies and more individuals are going to want to live in New York because the schools will be better. And if you have better subways, more people are going to want to live and work in New York because, you know, you won't have to be trapped on a train for 2 hours in the morning when it breaks down.
Right.
But nobody looks at those kind of expenses as investments in your city and investments in your economy, whereas somehow when it's giving money to a large corporation, that's suddenly, well, this isn't really an expense or a giveaway. This is an investment.
And that view that you mentioned about investing in other things, that is the perspective that a number of community groups, I think, were trying to put forward. You know, the papers are attributing Amazon's pullout to politicians' pushback, which, of course, is very real. And the name of State Senator Michael Giannaris comes up a lot, along with Ocasio-Cortez. But those politicians are responding to community, you know, to groups like Align and Make the Road and Immigrant and Labor and People of Color and Students and Queens residents coalitions, you know, who had concerns about gentrification, as you pointed, that the jobs they suspected that were offered would not materialize or would not necessarily be jobs for locals. But they aren't saying we don't want any new businesses. They're saying in part that they want to be at the table. And I just wanted to ask you, the secrecy and the lack of public oversight has been such an element of this process from the beginning, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, that was Amazon's plan from the beginning, right, was to conduct this bidding war among cities and states. And in the initial rounds, cities and states weren't even allowed to reveal what they were bidding, to try to keep everything hidden until the deal was done sort of under the table and then presented as a fait accompli to the public. And I think one thing that Amazon and presumably other companies have learned is that that doesn't go over very well, because you had, for example, the New York City Council upset that they were cut out of this deal because the state was going to take control of it and not give the city council any say. And obviously you had the public and, you know, all of these community groups that have really been spending the last decade or more gearing up for a fight over increased housing costs, which are out of control in New York, out of, you know, the city and state giving priority and funding to these sort of big mega projects, as opposed to, you know, other sort of more community-friendly projects or small businesses or any even number of things you could think of. And I think one of the things that's interesting about what the strategies were and what was successful is the one thing that Amazon really didn't realize was that people were going to go after it, not just for the subsidies, but for the rest of its business. Right. And, you know, from all the reporting that we've seen since Amazon pulled out, it really does seem like they were offended that anyone would criticize them on their anti-union policies or on their partnering with ICE on anti-immigrant policies. Yeah. So it was remarkably successful as a grassroots campaign to target Amazon's credibility and its status as a good company. And I think it's very interesting that Amazon pulled out saying, yeah, we thought we were going to get the money anyway. We just didn't want to have to face all these questions.
Well, that's an excellent tip for community organizers and for reporters as well, who questions are meant to be your stock in trade. There is now actual legislation to do with cities and communities offering tax incentives and competing with one another. There's a sense that states need to get together on this or it's not going to work. Do you see much hope in terms of this whole idea of beating back the very use of these subsidies as ways to lure corporations?
I think certainly New York State and other states could be looking at legislation to scale back some of these subsidy programs, to investigate whether they are actually doing anything positive, whether the public is getting a good bang for their buck. And I think in terms of some of these interstate compacts that people are talking about, it's a great idea, but it's really hard to enforce, right? Because if 10 states get together and say, we're not going to offer tax breaks in order for companies to locate in our states, then the other 40 can just say, oh, okay, great for us. We're going to go and do that instead. And it's hard to have a non-aggression pact when you don't have everybody on board, which is why I think most people think that the federal government really needs to be involved. And it would be trivially easy for Congress to put an end to all these local level corporate subsidy wars tomorrow. There was a bill in Congress 20 years ago now that would have just placed a high tax on any local level corporate subsidies. So if Amazon gets $3 billion in tax breaks from New York City, then they have to pay, I don't know, $1 billion or $2 billion or $3 billion, you could make it, in federal taxes, which, you know, completely eliminates any benefit that they would get from that and eliminates any benefit they would get from trying to, you know, stage one of these bidding wars. That bill didn't get anywhere in 1998, and I don't think it would come close to passing today. But the fact that, you know, we're talking about this and that, again, the media is sort of slowly starting to grapple with some of these issues, was at least a promising sign that maybe the heyday of massive tax breaks for any company that can threaten to leave town or threaten not to come to your town, we're starting to see a light at the very end of the tunnel.
We've been speaking with journalist Neil DeMoss. You can find his recent work on Amazon and other issues on Gothamist.com. There's more work on DeMoss.net. Neil DeMoss, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Put in effect in 1984 by Ronald Reagan, the Mexico City policy prevents foreign organizations that receive U.S. government funding from performing abortions, even if they are using funds from non-U.S. government sources, and even if abortion is completely legal in their country. But it's better known as the Global Gag Rule because it does more. preventing funding for agencies that counsel, refer, or advocate for abortion, forcing NGOs and healthcare providers to choose between crucial resources and their ability to provide the best care for their patients, including speaking freely about the full range of safe legal options. The rule has been revoked and reinstated as the White House has changed parties until Donald Trump, on his first full day in office, not only put it back, but expanded it categorically. Now the gag rule applies not just to family planning funding, but to all global health funding, some $9 billion a year worth of aid, including that going to projects fighting HIV/AIDS and malaria. Will Donald Trump's yet again making a bad thing worse be enough to generate some real scrutiny on this harmful policy? And is proposed new legislation a way to real change? We're joined now by Nina Besser-Dorley. She's Senior Program Officer in U.S. Foreign Policy at the International Women's Health Coalition. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Nina Besser-Dorley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I wonder if you could tell us some of what we already knew about the impacts of the global gag rule even before Donald Trump's expansion of it, which is obviously very, very significant. But even before that, we do have a record. There is evidence of the impact of this gag rule, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. What we've seen under previous incarnations of this policy is that it has led to a reduced access to services. It's made it harder for women to access a complete spectrum of reproductive health care, including abortion, but also contraception and other really critical reproductive health services. It's also had a really chilling effect on civil society. It's limited how organizations can collaborate with each other, what organizations who do sign the gag rule and accept U.S. government funding with the conditions, what they can participate in. And so it's had these really wide-ranging effects. There's one really interesting study from Stanford University that looked at the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration's gag rule, and found that it led to clinic closures, it led to reduced services, it led to reduced access to contraceptives. And in turn, it led to an increase in abortions in sub-Saharan Africa, which is where the study looked.
Well, it's interesting that it would lead to an increase in abortions. It's interesting if you think, oh, but wait, I thought it was, you know, anti-abortion, but it's really not confusing. If you cut off access to birth control, well, that's going to have certain repercussions. So in a way, it makes a certain kind of sense if you don't go at it thinking that abortion somehow is isolated from the rest of reproductive health care.
Yeah, absolutely. This policy does nothing to reduce the amount women need abortion services. It just makes those services harder to access and harder to access in safe and legal settings.
Well, and now we see Donald Trump expanding this to where it's not just about family planning funding, but all healthcare funding. I've read that in some places, like in the Netherlands, they're trying to do their own fundraising to try and fill the gap, but they just don't think it's anywhere near possible to match the funding that groups will lose if they decide not to sign on to this gag rule. I mean, it was bad before, but this really does take things up an order of magnitude, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So in previous versions of this policy, it applied only to family planning and reproductive health funding. So if you took those categories of funding, you had to abide by the conditions of this policy. And that's a pot of money that's about $500 million a year. Significant and important. But what we're talking about now is the Trump administration has applied this to all global health funding, which is something upwards of $9 billion a year. And the U.S. is the largest funder of global health worldwide. And these are gaps that can't be made up by other donors.
Well, you talked about the sort of ripple effect. It can be difficult to convey to people because it's at a community level, right, where a clinic that provides comprehensive care, they do lots of things, may have to close. And, of course, that's going to affect everybody and not only pregnant women, but also societal level groups that might want to advocate to their own government for freer access to abortion now don't have this funding that might be needed to support themselves, you know? So it really affects the climate of conversation within these countries.
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, we're talking about now groups that accept HIV funding, groups that get funding for TB programs, groups that get funding for non-communicable diseases. And in many cases, it's exactly as you paint it. There's one clinic that provides all of these services. They may take funding for, say, TB, and now they're in a country where abortion is legal and where they were previously providing that as part of their package of reproductive health care. They're forced to choose. Are they going to forego the TB funding and no longer be able to provide those services to the people in the community who count on them? Or are they going to continue to accept that funding and no longer be able to offer the comprehensive set of reproductive health care that is legal in their country and that, you know, women in the community were relying on? And these are really painful decisions for providers and for organizations that are put in this position to make this call.
Yeah, I would just underscore, you know, by this rule, groups that advocate for more or freer access to abortion can't get funding. But if they're advocating for restrictions on abortion, they can still get funding. So in terms of affecting just the conversational climate, well, I think when folks are thinking about domestically, we might remember Henry Hyde in pushing the Hyde Amendment, which means that women can't use Medicaid funding for abortion. But I want to remind about how he said in 1977, quote, "I certainly would like to prevent, if I could legally, anybody having an abortion, a rich woman, a middle-class woman, or a poor woman. Unfortunately, the only vehicle available is the Medicaid bill," close quote. I think, in a sense, there are things that folks can't do domestically that they can do through aid programs. And for other countries, it's very obvious that this is an ideological thing and that it doesn't have anything to do with medicine or safety or women's well-being or economic growth or anything like that. I feel like we have to kind of call it out for what it is, right? Which has to do much more with control over women than with concerns about health care.
And I think it's really important to note that this administration is trying to bring this policy home. They have a draft HHS regulation that's currently being finalized. I've heard it could be out any day now, that looks to impose a very similar version of a gag rule to Title X funding in this country. And it's not a coincidence that, you know, they rolled this policy out in the global sphere, in the foreign assistance sphere, which, as you mentioned, is sort of easier to see as over there and not about us. They rolled that out right at the beginning of the administration. And now, a couple of years in, they're pushing much harder to implement the same agenda and the same ideology in their domestic policy.
Well, the thing is, though, that most Americans do still want women to have the right to choose when and if they give birth. Senator Jeanne Shaheen told BuzzFeed right after Trump's initial move, "If you're doing it to try and limit abortion, if you're doing it to try and support stronger families and healthier children and mothers, it does none of those things." You know, talking about the gag rule, Representative Nita Lowey said that the new policy, the expansion of the gag rule, doesn't make any sense, and that irrationality might be the biggest concern, you know, because maybe they don't even realize the impact that this is going to have. Shaheen and Lowy, of course, are co-sponsors of something called the Global Health Empowerment and Rights, or HER Act. How is that legislation, how would that be responsive to the problem that we're talking about?
The Global HER Act would legislatively solve this problem, both in the immediate and the long term. It would take away the president's ability to put this policy into effect. So it would basically say that organizations who provide legally permissive abortion services are eligible to receive U.S. government funding. It would take away the possibility of using that as a criteria to not fund organizations. And I think this is really important because it's important that we end this policy now, but because it's gone back and forth between Republican and Democratic administrations, it has impacts in Global South countries, even when it's not in place, because it's really hard for organizations, particularly small community-based organizations, to completely reframe and reassess their health programming based on the whims of whoever's in power in Washington. So this legislation is really important because it would permanently end the global gag rule.
Well, I actually meant to mention that, you know, it almost goes without saying, but of course you have to say it, and there's a new book called Crow After Roe that kind of evokes it. When access to abortion is restricted, people are affected differently, you know, and poor and rural and women of color bear the brunt. And what I hear you saying is that happens even when it's just a threat or even when it's just hanging over people's heads. It already has that impact, and that impact is felt differently by different communities.
Absolutely. I mean, my organization has started a project documenting the impacts of Trump's version of the global gag rule. And that's one of the first things that came out of that research and documentation effort is that it is the people who already have the hardest time accessing health care, whether it's young people, rural people, LGBT communities, other marginalized groups. It's those communities that feel the effects of this first, as clinics that they trust start to close, as places that they have access to begin to lose funding and have to scale down services. Those are the people who feel these impacts first and most acutely.
Well, let me just ask you finally, what is the situation with the Global HER Act? It has, it's, I believe, a great deal of support that is bipartisan. What should we be looking for in days ahead in terms of that legislation?
I think it's really important to note that versions of this legislation have passed both the Senate Appropriations Committee on a bipartisan vote last year and the full House earlier this year, again, as part of an appropriations vote. So we're really close. You know, and I think it's going to be critical in the coming weeks and months to really bring to bear the stories of impact that we already have, the evidence we've already gathered around the impacts of these policies, to really bring to Congress a full picture of exactly how devastating this policy, and particularly this Trump version of the policy, is in communities to help push that bill ahead.
We've been speaking with Nina Besser-Dorley. She's Senior Program Officer in U.S. Foreign Policy at the International Women's Health Coalition. They're online at IWHC.org. Her article with Vanessa Rios, "The Global Gag Rule Has Put Women in Danger for Decades, Here's How We Can Stop It," can be found at rewire.news. Nina Besser-Dorley, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A hotter world doesn't just melt polar glaciers faster, raising sea levels around the world. New science says melting glaciers lead to a hotter world. Plus, episodes of glaciers and ice shelves falling into the sea can make the weather one year very different from the next. From New Zealand, ice expert Nicholas Golich joins us. But first, from California, Dr. Robert Allen reveals pollution has hidden up to half a degree C of warming. I think the 2 degree supposed safe line is already in the rearview mirror. This is Radio EcoShock. Prepare to live in a very different world. It is already pretty strange. Talking with CKUW Radio in Winnipeg, Canada, a weak jet stream left the freezer door open. After a few weeks getting down to minus 39.9 degrees C, about the same in Fahrenheit, folks there are ready for some global warming. Where Tasmania was super hot with giant fires, it snowed in the highlands a few days later, just like the strange snow in Hawaii last week. California has been drowning in rain, atmospheric rivers, and that turns to mega snow in the mountains, while the slopes burned out in last year's fires break into rivers of mud, taking out homes and highways. Back in Australia, following that brutal heat, a mega river up to 37 miles wide, 60 kilometers, suddenly appeared in the bed of a smallish river in Queensland. Folks in the Swiss and Austrian Alps are digging out of mountains of snow. That all is in the neutral ocean conditions, but scientists have just announced a new tilt. El Nino has formed in the eastern Pacific. That usually leads to more record hot weather around the world. Prediction is pretty hard. The future has been destabilized. You can't see them, but you are surrounded by billions of tiny particles. When bits of dust or droplets hang in the air, scientists call them aerosols. In the atmosphere, aerosols protect us a little bit from being too hot. As smog, they kill us by the millions every year. What happens to aerosols as the world heats up even more? We need to know. Our guest, Dr. Robert Allen, wades into what may be one of the most complex questions of science. After getting his PhD in atmosphere, ocean, and climate dynamics at Yale, Robert was a postdoctoral scholar at various places, including at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. We have called Dr. Allen about his new paper, Enhanced Land-Sea Warming Contrast Elevates Aerosol Pollution in a Warmer World. From the University of California, Dr. Allen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Bob, when you're out in public, how do you explain what an aerosol is?
I describe it as basically a suspension of fine particles in the atmosphere. They could be liquid or solid, but from a climate standpoint, we're more interested in the solid particles because they have an impact on Earth's energy balance, which has important implications for the climate system of the planet. And they also have an impact on human health. When we talk about aerosols, we usually break them down into two different categories. We have anthropogenic aerosol, man-made aerosol. And these are things like your sulfates, your nitrates, your organic aerosol. And then we also have natural aerosols, which are kind of emitted, for the most part, independent of humans. And natural aerosols constitute basically dust and sea salt.
When sunlight arrives on Earth, some of it bounces and radiates back out into space, but some of the sun's energy is held within the Earth's atmosphere by greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide. And a significant portion of the sun's light never reaches the surface because it strikes aerosols first. What happens up there?
Yeah, so these aerosol particles, like I mentioned before, impact Earth's energy balance. And aerosols generally absorb or reflect sunlight. So depending on the aerosol species, so for example, sulfate aerosol is basically 100% scattering aerosol, whereas maybe like a black carbon aerosol is one of the anthropogenic aerosol species that actually absorbs sunlight. So the mixture of these various anthropogenic aerosols ultimately results in less sunlight reaching the surface of our planet, and that has a net cooling effect. So overall, we think these anthropogenic aerosols have had a overall cooling impact on the planet, and they've essentially offset some of the warming that we would have expected from the increase in greenhouse gases.
They've kind of hidden our real situation.
Yes, this is true. It turns out that we've been running a bit of a geoengineering experiment, even though we haven't really acknowledged it, in that we've been emitting greenhouse gases, which cause warming of the planet, and is the major focus of climate change. But then we've also been emitting these anthropogenic aerosol particles, which has a bit of a it kind of counters some of the warming that we would have gotten from the increase in greenhouse gases. So obviously, aerosols are a bit complicated because on one hand, they've offset some of the warming that we would have received. But on the other hand, aerosols have a negative impact on human health. We want to clean up the atmosphere from aerosols and air pollution to mitigate premature death. But if we do that, that's going to basically exacerbate greenhouse gas-induced global warming.
So maybe this is a foolish question, but why don't the greenhouse gases capture the energy reflected by aerosols in the lower atmosphere?
So greenhouse gases and aerosols interact with different parts of electromagnetic radiation. So greenhouse gases primarily absorb longer wave radiation that our planet is basically re-emitting back to space. Aerosol particles, on the other hand, do not really interact with this long-wave terrestrial radiation. They primarily interact with the solar radiation that is coming into our climate system. So greenhouse gases basically don't interact with shortwave solar energy like the aerosols do.
Well, we have a general number for the number of parts per million of carbon dioxide, and lately the latest reading I saw was 414 parts per million, which is very concerning. Do we have a general number for the amount of global dimming caused by aerosols preventing that light from reaching the ground or the seas?
Yeah, we do. Basically, the emission of anthropogenic aerosols peaked in the 1970s and 1980s. And over this, 1970-1980 time frame, I think some estimates of the amount of global dimming are on the order of, 3 or 4 watts per meter squared for the Northern Hemisphere. And that, in turn, has been implicated in reducing Northern Hemisphere precipitation over this time frame. And it's possibly also associated with the devastating drought that the Sahel experienced in the 1970s and 1980s. Since the 70s and 80s, the United States and Europe in particular have implemented some air pollution policies that have resulted in a decrease in anthropogenic aerosol emissions. However, this has kind of been outweighed to some extent from a global perspective by continued increases, or enhanced increases, I should say, in parts of Asia, China and India in particular.
All right. We're ready to talk about the new paper, Enhanced Land-Sea Warming Contrast Elevates Aerosol Pollution in a Warmer World, where you are the lead author, and it was published February 4th, 2019, in the prestigious journal Nature Climate Change. Now, there's a stunning statement in the introduction which says, quote, aerosols cause a net cooling effect, which probably has offset about 40% of greenhouse gas warming, unquote. And that's half the real warming potential getting shielded by pollution, if I'm reading it right, both man-made and natural. Does that mean we've created warming that is really 40% worse than we're experiencing so far? Or does it imply a change in time, putting off the arrival of the heat? I don't really understand what that figure means.
That figure of 40% is referring to the fact that we've offset approximately 40% of the warming that we should have felt due to the increase in greenhouse gases, simply due to the fact that we've been co-emitting anthropogenic aerosols, which have resulted in a net cooling effect due to their enhanced reflection of incoming sunlight. You know, the implication of this is that, again, if we were to try to clean up the atmosphere and improve air quality, that implies a reduction in these anthropogenic aerosol emissions, which implies a reduction in this cooling effect that we've implemented over the 20th century. And that, in turn, suggests that greenhouse gas-induced climate change and global warming will accelerate. I mean, there's been a couple of recent studies that have come out where they've basically, in a climate model, you can kind of run some idealized simulations, and they ask the question, well, if we remove all anthropogenic aerosol species from this climate model, how much does the planet warm? They looked at a couple different models because there's some uncertainty in the aerosol effects on the climate system, and they found something like 0.5 to 1 degree C of warming if we completely remove all anthropogenic aerosol species. So that's a massive number. right now the planet's warmed about 1 degree C over the 20th century due to the increase in greenhouse gases. So this offsetting effect that aerosols have is very significant.
It sure is. And I know you published about my next question back in 2010 with Australia's Stephen Sherwood. What is the share of total aerosol shielding coming from natural sources and how much from human activity?
I guess if you were to compare the amount of anthropogenic aerosol in the atmosphere versus the amount of natural aerosol, the amount of natural aerosol is much, much larger than the amount of anthropogenic aerosol, by probably several times larger. But the important thing here from a climate change standpoint is the change in these aerosol species over time. Over the 20th century, the increase in anthropogenic aerosol emissions has been very large, and the change in natural aerosol emissions has generally assumed to be essentially very small. So it's the change that we're most concerned with when we're referring to the climate change impacts of aerosol.
And can scientists further break down how much of these aerosols come from, say, burning fossil fuels like cars, trucks, planes, and ships, and how much from other human activities like farming or agrochemicals or land use changes?
That depends on the anthropogenic aerosol species that you're concerned with. Something like a sulfate aerosol, for example, which forms in the atmosphere through the oxidation of sulfur dioxide, most SO2 is emitted by fossil fuel power plants that primarily use coal as their main fossil fuel energy source. When you're talking about something like a black carbon aerosol, it's about 40% biomass burning, so things like savanna clearing and deforestation. And the remaining 60% is due to fossil fuels, primarily things like diesel engines, for example. But there's also biofuel. Biofuel is another large component of black carbon emissions. A lot of people living in developing countries still use wood as their primary source to heat their home or cook their food. And that results in a large emissions of these black carbon aerosols.
Oh, boy. I'm heating with wood, so I'm contributing, too. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, they use a figure of 0.9 watts per meter squared for radiative forcing from aerosols. And the uncertainty range, though, is huge. The IPCC suggests the radiative forcing could be twice as much or one-ninth as much as their 0.9 figure. So have scientists narrowed that range since, and does that uncertainty greatly affect the results of your paper?
Yeah, this is one of the frustrating aspects if you're in the game of climate science and trying to understand the effects of aerosols on the climate system, is that aerosols, as well as clouds, are the main uncertainties for understanding the climate system and human perturbations to the climate system. The uncertainty range hasn't really decreased very much, so that's a bit sobering. A lot of it has to do with the very complicated interactions that these submicron-sized particles have on the climate system. And I think another component of this is that there are multiple interactions and feedbacks within the climate system that make it very difficult to understand how, you know, a submicron particle can have an impact on this much larger system. In the context of my study, the uncertainty in the radiative forcing of aerosols is not particularly important, because we weren't focused on trying to understand the radiative effects of these aerosols. We were just focused on trying to understand how climate change impacts the amount of aerosol in the atmosphere.
And what did you find?
Well, we found that if you assume kind of a business-as-usual scenario where we continue combusting greenhouse gases at the current rate, you keep anthropogenic aerosol emissions fixed at, say, a present-day value, by the end of the century, the burden of anthropogenic aerosols will increase in response to this greenhouse gas-induced warming.
That's kind of strange, because we know that, for example, in China, people are trying to clean up the air, and yet you're saying that the conditions from climate change will actually lead towards an increase of aerosols. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So you can think of the amount of aerosol in the atmosphere, it's primarily a function of your emissions, but then it's also a function of other processes operating in the atmosphere, including transport and removal. So when you perturb the climate system, for example, you warm it through an increase in greenhouse gases, then that impacts the atmospheric circulation, the winds, the precipitation patterns, the relative humidity, and those in turn have an impact on the transport of aerosols and their removal. And what we found is a relatively robust response, particularly in the northern hemisphere mid-latitudes, where these continents warm up at a faster rate than the corresponding ocean surface, and this promotes enhanced continental aridity. So basically enhanced drying of the continents. And this drying is linked to several climate parameters, including decreases in soil moisture, decreases in relative humidity, but we also found a decrease in what we call large-scale precipitation. And most of these aerosol species, the dominant removal mechanism is, in fact, precipitation. So if you reduce the amount of precipitation, you effectively reduce the amount of removal of these aerosol species. And that's ultimately what we argue is driving the increase in aerosol burden in response to future warming.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Robert Allen from the University of California, Riverside. We're talking about how new science projecting how pollution will behave in a hotter world. Your paper, Bob, in Nature Climate Change says the latest models show a greater shielding of Earth from the sun during the hottest times of the year in the Northern Hemisphere summer. For those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, isn't that a good thing, helping to shade us from what would be the worst of the heat?
That is a good thing in that, yes, these aerosols have a net negative impact on the energy balance of the planet, which would result in surface cooling. But this effect is going to be much, much, much smaller than the warming perturbation due to the increase in greenhouse gases. And maybe more importantly, as I mentioned earlier, these aerosols not only impact the climate system, but they have a negative impact on human health.
As you know, we're experiencing more extreme precipitation events, whether it's dumps of snow like we're getting where I am right now, or inches of rain. And this is happening all over the world. The IPCC released a special report saying extreme precipitation events will increase as the world heats up. Won't that extra rain wash out even more pollution, revealing the true heat from the emissions we've released?
That's a good question, and that's a bit of a subtlety on the effects of precipitation on removal of these aerosol particles. It's generally thought that if you increase the intensity of rainfall, that's not necessarily going to result in enhanced removal of these aerosol species, because the process becomes saturated at a certain level of rainfall intensity, that increasing the intensity of rainfall above this threshold doesn't result in a net increase in aerosol removal. And there have been a couple studies that have looked at this, and it's basically a distinction between the intensity of precipitation and the frequency of precipitation. And it may be the case that the frequency of precipitation is more important in dictating the removal of these aerosol species than the intensity.
Could you tell us a bit more about the dominant driver that you found that you call the land-sea warming contrast? What is that? Take whatever time you need to explain that for us, would you?
Yeah, it's a very fundamental result in climate change. It's supported by model simulations, and it's supported by kind of fundamental theory. And basically, it just involves when you increase greenhouse gases, the land warms more than the corresponding oceans. So that's what the land-sea warming contrast is. And it has a couple different ways it can be explained. In terms of the ocean, the oceans have greater thermal inertia than do the continents. So, for example, they can transport some of the heat that they absorb to depth, thereby creating the surface less warm than it otherwise would be. But there are other processes involved that are probably more important, and it has to do with the fact that there are moisture limitations over land, whereas these same moisture limitations obviously don't exist over the ocean. So one of the fundamental quantities that we often use to try to better understand the land-sea warming contrast is the breakdown between sensible and latent heating. And over the ocean, like I said, you basically have an unlimited amount of moisture, so a lot of the incoming energy can go into evaporation. And that, by definition, it's latent energy. It doesn't manifest itself in terms of a change in temperature. But over the continents, where moisture is more limited, more of the incoming energy can go into sensible heating. So that's one explanation. And there are a few others involving differences in boundary layer, land-sea contrast, and lapse rates. And there are also considerations involving changes in relative humidity between the land and the ocean. Yeah, it's basically just the land warms up at a faster rate than does the ocean.
A few weeks ago, we talked with the young scientist Yang-Yang Shu at Texas A&M. And he found, looking at the attempted cleanup of pollution in China, that local meteorological conditions would likely encourage even more smog despite that cleanup effort. For example, there'd be more stagnation days and the precipitation might increase, but there would be more dry days in between that. Does that basically agree with what your study found?
Yeah, that's a similar argument as what we are proposing. I guess stagnation has a component that's related to precipitation, as you mentioned, but it also has a component related to wind speeds. So if you have a decrease in, say, upper level or surface wind speeds, then that promotes the accumulation of aerosol particles in that region, which obviously leads to a reduction in air quality. Some of these aerosol particles form through reactions within the atmosphere. So as the conditions for stagnation, if they were to increase, then there would be more time for these precursor particles to react with other aerosol species and sunlight to form these secondary organic aerosols. So it's generally arguing along the same lines as what we are.
Robert Allen, let's break off for a minute to discuss something I learned from your previous paper in 2012. I should have known this, but I didn't know that the tropics are expanding north and south as the world warms. You say it's not directly caused by greenhouse gas emissions, but something else. What is causing the tropics to expand, and how do we know that?
Yeah, this is a topic of intense research, actually. The causes of tropical expansion are multiple. There are multiple explanations, and it also depends on the hemisphere, northern hemisphere versus southern hemisphere. I want to start off by saying that greenhouse gases do cause the tropics to widen, but there are other components. I argue that these absorbing aerosols, the black carbon aerosols that we previously discussed, are a driver of tropical widening in the northern hemisphere. And in the southern hemisphere, the depletion of stratospheric ozone has also been implicated in the polar expansion of the tropical belt in the southern hemisphere.
Well, this isn't a little thing. I mean, you cite a 2008 paper by Seidel et al., and you suggest the tropics expanded by somewhere between 2 to 5 degrees of latitude since 1979, not that long ago. And I used rough back-of-the-envelope calculations at the high end of 5 degrees latitude. That moves the tropics about 350 miles or 550 kilometers closer to most of my listeners. That must have huge implications for humans and the planet.
Yeah, so the Seidel paper that you referred to was kind of one of the first manuscripts that discussed this idea that the tropics were widening. The number you quote, 2 to 5 degrees of latitude of widening, was a very preliminary calculation. And there's been a lot of subsequent follow-on studies that have tried to use additional observational data sets to quantify the rate at which the tropics have been widening. And it's generally thought that it's probably on the lower side of that range, so something more like 2 degrees. In a recent publication that I was just looking at was quoting a rate of tropical widening of about 0.5 degrees latitude per decade since 1979. So again, that's about 2 degrees total widening.
That's about 140 miles maybe of widening since 1979 at the low end.
Yeah, and the implications of tropical widening, from my perspective, the main implication is basically an expansion of the subtropical dry zone. This is kind of the place on the planet where we have most of the world's deserts, and it's due to kind of the subsiding branch of the Hadley circulations in both hemispheres. And as we continue to warm the planet and the boundaries of the tropical edge moves further poleward, you can think of that as an expansion of these subtropical dry zones. That's probably the biggest implication in terms of an impact on humans and the ecosystem.
Now, on your webpage, a description of your research introduces another unsettling complexity to this already tough problem of aerosols. You talk about a process where aerosols have an indirect effect of reducing cloud formation. Could you explain that for us?
Yeah, just to back up a second, you know, this is why quantification of the radiative impacts of aerosols is so difficult and why the uncertainty is so large. They generally have three different impacts. They have what we call these direct effects, which I've been previously describing as the scattering and absorption of solar radiation. Aerosol particles also serve as cloud condensation nuclei, so they have indirect impacts on clouds through changes in cloud microphysics. It's thought that an increase in aerosol particles makes clouds brighter, enhancing the albedo of our planet. They probably also lead to a suppression of precipitation, but depends on the type of cloud. If you're looking at convective cloud, these aerosol microphysical effects may actually invigorate convection. And then there's an additional way in which aerosols can impact the climate system are these semi-direct effects, whereby an absorbing aerosol, like this black carbon aerosol, heats the atmospheric column, which results in a reduction in the relative humidity and decreases the cloud cover. But it turns out that there are multiple semi-direct effects that are dependent on kind of the co-location of the black carbon and the cloud. So this cloud desiccation effect that I was just referring to is kind of the situation where the black carbon and the cloud are co-located. But if black carbon is actually, say, above like a low-lying cloud, like a marine stratocumulus, then that actually could result in the opposite effect, where you have an increase in cloud cover. This is why reducing the uncertainty in aerosol effects on the climate system is difficult, and why the uncertainty kind of remains relatively large today.
Yeah, we talked to another atmospheric scientist, Tim Garrett, who said clouds are really almost the frontier of science still. It's so hard to nail down how mists and smoke and invisible particles move around, especially in an uncertain future with climate change. There must be a lot of known unknowns, and do you expect surprises still to come?
Possibly. I mean, I guess in terms of the main areas of uncertainty when it comes to understanding the aerosol impacts on the climate system generally have to do with their impacts on clouds. Most of the uncertainty in aerosol impacts on the climate system are directly related to their impacts on cloud microphysics. Another significant source of uncertainty has to do with the vertical profile of these aerosols, particularly the absorbing aerosols. Because like I mentioned before, if you're interested in trying to understand these semi-direct effects, the vertical co-location of the absorbing aerosol relative to the cloud is important. But if we don't know where the black carbon is in a vertical atmospheric column, then that makes it difficult to quantify this effect. And a lot of these uncertainties have to do with the fact that it's very difficult to observe clouds and aerosols out in the real world. And when it comes to something like a satellite, for example, the main quantity that we observe through satellites is something called the aerosol optical depth. And that is basically just a vertically integrated quantity that tells you something about the amount of sunlight that the aerosol is scattering or absorbing. So it doesn't really tell us anything about the type of aerosol or where the aerosol is located vertically and where that aerosol is located relative to the clouds. So there's a lot of uncertainties. I think a lot of these uncertainties can be reduced by improved observational measurements and probably some finer scale type modeling where we incorporate more of these microphysical effects, like a cloud resolving model, for example.
Bob Allen, are you personally worried about climate change? Do you think we're going to see some serious times in the future because we're not acting in time?
I am concerned about climate change on many levels. I think that some of the more negative impacts, for example, sea level rise, changes in vector-borne diseases like malaria and dengue. We had like a Zika outbreak that I'd never heard of 2 years ago that actually impacted places in the United States, like Miami, for example. Possible, you know, international conflicts, environmental refugees, more extreme weather events like hurricanes, for example. These are all very scary. And, you know, even the United States, you know, I live in Southern California in California, and, you know, we've had some pretty big natural disasters over the last couple of years. We had a massive wildfire a few months ago, Paradise, California. It's the largest wildfire in California's history. These are all concerns. They're very significant concerns, and you know, we're going down a path that I don't want to continue going down. Unfortunately, the United States is kind of dragging its feet right now. So,
well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time, but I know that the science that you're doing will help us at least picture what we're dealing with, and maybe that will be a first step towards some sort of solution. We've been speaking with Dr. Robert Allen, climatologist and associate professor at UC Riverside. We've been talking about the paper Enhanced Land-Sea Warming Contrast Elevates Aerosol Pollution in a Warmer World, published in Nature Climate Change. I will put links to all the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Bob, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
New science predicts chaotic climate with bigger changes in temperatures year to year. Our next guest told Scientific American, quote, "This unpredictability is going to prove extremely disruptive for all of us and will make adaptation and planning much more difficult," end quote. And the driver for all of that comes from the furthest ends of the Earth. It's not what you would expect. We're going to talk about ice melt on Antarctica and Greenland, and yes, that will affect you. There is also a small sliver of possibly better news. The most apocalyptic predictions for sea level rise may not happen. Our guest, Nicholas Gollidge, is lead author of one paper just published in Nature and co-author of another. He has 68 more peer-reviewed scientific papers to his credit. Educated in Scotland, Associate Professor Nick Gollidge is currently with the Antarctic Research Center, and that's at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. From Wellington, Nick, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
So I gather it's been a crazy busy week for you, Nick, with the media calling from all over the world?
It was very busy last week, yeah. So it's nice that we got a lot of coverage. So, yeah, very happy about that.
It's an important story. Now, you begin your new work by assuming that despite the aims of the Paris Agreement, the global mean temperature will exceed the alleged safe limits, going towards 2.6, maybe even to 4 degrees C beyond pre-industrial. Why do you think that's a scenario that you should work with?
Those numbers basically come from the Climate Action Tracker, which is an online resource which uses climate model scenarios to basically forecast the range of warming that we're likely to reach by 2100, taking into account the various government pledges. It's a dynamic website that they update periodically as governments either improve or remove some of their climate pledges. So that number has kind of changed a little bit over the last couple of years because of electoral changes in some countries. But yeah, for the last year or two, it's been fairly set on predicting more than 3 degrees warming by 2100.
And we won't mention any names like the United States or Brazil and all that. Okay, so when the governments met in Katowice, Poland in December 2018, did the projections given to them by international scientists include the impacts of ice sheet discharge?
Well, of course, I can't say specifically what was given to them, but I think globally most policymakers are still using predictions from the last IPCC assessment, the AR5 assessment, which was completed in 2013. I know for sure that none of the climate models that were used in that assessment included the effects of ice sheet melt. Now, of course, the IPCC was tasked with delivering some special reports, which are beginning to come online now. So in some of those reports, they may be at least referring to some of the literature which talks about these effects. But there's always this sort of slight latency between, you know, when we do the science and how quickly that can get into, you know, both into publication and into big documents like IPCC assessments. So it's partly just fault of the process. And, you know, I think as scientists and communicators, we actually need to find faster mechanisms to get our message to decision makers.
Well, there's a couple of things we need to talk about here. One is the changes in ocean currents that could destabilize the weather, especially in the northern hemisphere. And then there's sea level rise, and I'd like to start with that. On Radio EcoShock, at least a dozen scientists have said sea level rise, not heat, will be the great game changer emerging out of a shifting climate. And it's, you know, about disappearing port cities, millions of people displaced, agricultural problems, and so on. But the predictions for sea level rise by 2100 have been all over the place, Nick. They run from a low of just 30 centimeters, or about 1 foot, to as much as 7 meters, or 21 feet. Nick, why is there such a difference, all coming from pretty good scientists?
Yeah, this is something that people rightly pick up on. And I think we need to break this down into some of the individual components. You know, when we think about global mean sea level rise, what we're talking about is very much an average value across the globe that comes from a range of different things. You know, we've got a thermal expansion component, which is, you know, fairly well understood, and we can kind of predict that fairly well based on predicted warming. We've got the contribution that comes from mountain glaciers and ice caps, and of course, they tend to respond fairly linearly to warming air temperature, so they're fairly predictable as well. And then we have the big problem with the ice sheets, and we've got Greenland, which generally responds to the atmosphere mainly, so it's a surface mass balance issue. So again, we can kind of predict that fairly well in terms of, you know, how it responds to a warming world. And actually, the model simulations for Greenland, there is some variability, obviously, between the models, but the ones that include dynamic contributions as well as surface melting, they give a little extra contribution to sea level, but there's not a huge difference. The real elephant in the room, as you allude to, is the Antarctic ice sheet, and particularly the dynamic contribution that comes from Antarctica. So in the last IPCC report, in AR5, they separated out the contribution that they thought would come from Antarctica based on just changes in temperature, air temperature, the surface mass balance. And then they put in an estimate for what they thought could come from rapid ice dynamics. And the reason they had to estimate it was because at the time there weren't sufficiently complex ice sheet models that could really simulate this kind of rapid ice dynamic behavior. Now, since then, the community has responded to that. We now have many more ice sheet models that can do this kind of stuff. But, you know, we're still trying to get to grips with how we deal with the processes we know about. But then there's also the wild card of processes that we, you know, we maybe know about but haven't included in models. And so some of the very high estimates that came out in 2016 were based on one particular paper that where the authors decided to put in some mechanisms that we see in Greenland but we don't see in Antarctica, and they basically scaled them up and said, wow, look at this, you know, we get huge sea level rise. Now, those authors are now bringing their numbers back down. They presented new work at AGU last year, which considerably revised downward the 2100 predictions from around a meter back down to 30 centimeters or so from Antarctica. So there's big changes there. The rest of the community are still trying to get to grips with whether it's a scheme that we need to incorporate. I mean, for sure, we need to investigate it and understand how it works, how it's likely to play out. But these are all very, very active areas of scientific research and in some cases, quite sort of heated discussion. So, yeah, I mean, it's frustrating for us as a community, I think, to find so much variability in the predictions, because it kind of makes us look like we don't really know what we're doing. But actually, I'd say that over the last year or two, we're beginning to understand some of these mechanisms better. We're seeing greater convergence of predictions. So just finally, to just sort of touch on that very, very wide range of total sea levels that you mentioned, you know, what we're talking about there with these very, very high numbers, the 21 feet that you mentioned, you know, this is really the very, very upper end of the distribution. So we sort of think about sea level predictions in terms of a probability distribution. Now, if you take the very, very end of that long tail, it could be, you know, 21 feet, but actually the median value is probably somewhere near, you know, 1 meter, you know, 3 or 4 feet, something like that.
Right. You were partly talking about a 2015 paper led by Dave Pollard and Richard Alley from Penn State, and they were talking about hydrofracture or cliff failure. And I think this comes down to an issue that I've seen in various blogs and emails, people worrying about that instead of flowing into the sea from a pressure in an orderly way, this ice might just crack off in great masses and fall into the sea. Is that kind of the picture that we're discussing here?
Absolutely. That's a nice summary. Essentially, what the authors have sort of put forward is this idea that when a glacier flows into the sea, it might not have a floating tongue like an ice shelf. It might just have a vertical cliff. And we see this a lot in Greenland, you know, some of the outlet glaciers that are flowing into fjords. They're terminating in the ocean, but they have these vertical faces. And what happens is that as the flow of the glacier, you know, accelerates their fast-flowing glaciers, you get all these longitudinal stresses. So you're basically stretching the ice out as it flows into the ocean. You get a lot of crevassing. And, of course, if you get surface melting, all that water then tends to drain into the crevasses. And it can kind of act as a wedging force. It tries to split those crevasses apart. So combined with all the other stresses that are being applied to this poor little glacier, the scenario is that these sort of marine terminating glacier margins can basically just collapse of their own accord. Now, nobody really debates that that is a real process. And, you know, when we've seen it for years and people have written about tidewater glaciers around the world for many, many decades. The issue with the 2015 and 2016 papers was whether that scheme, that mechanism is translatable to Antarctica. And if it is, then at what scale can it realistically operate? You know, it's one thing to have a grounded margin in a confined fjord that fractures and carves icebergs. But if you then whole scale apply the same mechanism to something like the Ross Sea, where you have a floating ice shelf that's maybe, you know, 1,000 kilometers wide. If you lose that ice shelf, then you have an ice front that's a comparable width. Now, is it realistic to sort of think that that whole ice cliff would be collapsing in the same way as a narrow fjordal glacier that's maybe, you know, just a couple of tens of kilometers wide? So lots of uncertainty in that translation. And Rob DeConto and Dave Pollard were, you know, really pushing the envelope in terms of forcing the community to look at this and say, hey, you know, we need to think about this. Is this something that's going to be important? And, you know, that's how science moves forward. You know, they're absolutely right to do that. So the work that we have to do now is for more modeling groups to sort of take this on and try and implement the same process in different models and really try and understand what are the sort of physical bounds that control these kind of mechanisms. And if we go back to using very sort of well-constrained engineering-type models to understand the stresses and strains, do we get the same results as when DeConto and Pollard use their, you know, relatively coarse resolution whole continent ice sheet model? So, you know, lots of work to be done to really understand that.
For those keeping score at home, we're talking about, you can get an update from the paper Revisiting Antarctic Ice Loss Due to Marine Ice Cliff Instability, as published February 6, 2019 in the journal Nature. The lead author is Dr. Tasman Edwards from King's College London, with Nick, our guest, as a co-author. So we know, Nick, that the sea is not really level, and sea level rise will not be evenly distributed. As the ice sheets melt, where will the highest waters pile up, and where will the sea level actually go down?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. You know, we always sort of blindly assume that, you know, as you sort of put water into the ocean, it just sort of fills up like a bathtub. But, of course, there's lots of competing factors that complicate that pattern. And because of the rotation of the Earth and the changing gravitational attraction of these ice sheets, when they lose mass, basically because they're smaller, they exert a reduced gravitational pull on the ocean surface. So actually the water tends to drop away from the ice sheets because of the rotation and the reduced gravitational effects from the ice sheets. Most of the water tends to pile up in the mid latitudes, particularly in the central Pacific. So we start seeing, you know, this bulge in the sea level, something like 1.4 times the global mean in the mid-latitude areas, particularly sort of central Pacific and so on. So, you know, near to New Zealand, we obviously have a lot of our population come from the Southwest Pacific Islands, which are very low-lying, very vulnerable to that kind of enhanced sea level rise. For people in the U.S., they might be thinking more about friends and relatives in Hawaii, places like that, you know, although, you know, the mountains in Hawaii are protected to some extent from sea level rise. You know, a lot of the development is on the low ground near to the coast. So, you know, those places are going to be sort of disproportionately affected. Unfortunately, the areas where we're going to see lower sea levels are generally the areas where people don't live. So it's not even as though we can benefit greatly from that. So the closer you get to the ice sheet, the lower the sea levels is going to be. So, you know, around the Antarctic Peninsula, around West Antarctica, you might see a lowering of sea level, but that's not really going to help populations globally, unfortunately.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Nick Golage from the Antarctic Research Center in Wellington, New Zealand. We're talking about ice sheet melt in Antarctica and Greenland and how that could reshape our world. Let's move on to the other paper published in Nature on February 6th. The title is Global Environmental Consequences of 21st Century Ice Sheet Melt. What motivated you, Nick, to do this research?
This work came out of previous studies where we had looked at the Antarctic ice sheet, how it was going to change in a warmer world. And in 2015, we published a paper which was very much focused on the very long-term commitments that come from global warming. So this idea that, you know, as we warm the climate, we might be able to stabilize the climate at some point, but we set in motion a whole series of changes that are going to play out over hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So we did that work in 2015, and sort of on the back of that, started realizing that although that was kind of interesting scientifically, it was very hard to sort of communicate the urgency of climate change to people when you're talking thousands of years in the future. So there was kind of a need in my mind to sort of revisit that work and think more specifically about doing predictions for the present century, and also to think about doing both ice sheets. So in the past, I'd only looked at Antarctica. This time around, I wanted to look at the Greenland ice sheet as well. And because we chose to focus really just on this century, it did give us the advantage that we could run the models at a higher resolution. So the computational costs of going to high resolution mean that it's very hard to do long simulations. But if you're only interested in, you know, a century or two, then it becomes tractable. So that was kind of the driver for me to sort of start the ice sheet simulations. But I'd also been involved in a number of different studies over the years where we'd sort of looked at and investigated this interesting sort of feedback mechanism where meltwater from the ice sheets affects ocean circulation and in turn affects the atmosphere. So that was something that I was kind of keen to do as well, because up until now, nearly all the publications that have looked at these kind of interactions have always done that in a very conceptual way. It's always been kind of like, oh, let's take X amount of meltwater and a climate state of this, and we'll just put the two together and see what happens. I wanted to kind of redo that in a scenario-based way. So I thought, you know, we're doing the ice sheet simulations according to these representative concentration pathways, the IPCC climate scenarios. I thought we're in a perfect position now to use the outputs from those ice simulations to drive some climate simulations that can tell us about scenario-based climate perturbations. So those were kind of two parts of the study, and they sort of basically formed a kind of natural alliance in my mind. So that's kind of where we went with that.
Reading the two new papers, I got a small enlightenment, I think, but I could be off base. I'm not a scientist. But previously, most of my guests talked about the impact of warmer temperatures in the air and the ocean and how that would affect ice melt in Greenland and Antarctica. But it seems to me your team is saying the opposite almost. Ice melt will affect air temperatures and ocean currents. So is that a feedback, or is that just the way this planet constantly interacts from both ends?
It's a complicated planet, isn't it? We live in a world where we have so many complex interactions. And you know, as scientists, particularly as modelers, we're sort of trying to take apart the system and say, you know, what influences what? And of course, everything's interlinked so tightly that it's very hard to sort of find a starting point and say, well, let's start with this thing and see how it affects the other thing, because that other thing then affects something else, which then comes back to the first thing. So we sort of acknowledge that sort of interconnected aspect of the Earth system. And I guess what we try and do in most modeling experiments is try to sort of understand just one part of the puzzle. So we kind of know, I think, fairly well how, you know, changes in the atmosphere and changes in the ocean lead to changes in the ice sheet. But there's not been as much work done looking at, you know, how changes in the ice sheet affect the ocean and atmospheres.
The new paper resurrects another debate that's been going on for quite a long time. Many of us saw the movie The Day After Tomorrow. It shows North America rapidly freezing over, basically because the warm Gulf Stream stops flowing north. And scientists came out and quashed that as sci-fi and forget about it. But in fact, many in the scientific community have been saying nothing significant will happen to the North Atlantic overturning circulation, as scientists refer to it, for centuries to come. Your new paper stirs it up, suggesting we will see noticeable changes to those warming currents, even during this century. What's up?
You know, in the last couple of years, there is definitely more and more evidence that the strength of that overturning circulation has decreased in recent times. So it's something that we can observe. It's no longer a kind of what if. I mean, we know that it's weakening. I guess the question on most people's minds is, you know, will the weakening continue? Will it accelerate? Will we reach this point where it collapses? You know, one of the key things about the AMOC, this overturning circulation, is that it's a system that has been known for a long time to be essentially sort of, you know, bistable. You know, it can exist in its current state, or if it's perturbed enough, if we disrupt it enough, it can basically collapse. By that, we mean that the strength of the overturning reduces very, very rapidly to a point where the ocean circulation is in a very different kind of mode than it is now. And the interesting thing here is that this is a threshold type system. So we're working in a space where you can kind of gradually keep nudging something. It's kind of like pushing a boulder further and further towards the cliff edge. At some point, you get to a point where it just drops off the cliff. And that's what happens with the AMOC. You can push it and push it and push it, and then bang, it collapses. So depending on which models you look at, you might find that point of collapse might differ slightly. But we kind of know it's that sort of system, so that's why people are worried about it. I guess when people have done climate model simulations, ocean model simulations, they haven't included the ice sheet melt. And yet we know that there's this big sort of cold blob in the ocean around Greenland because of the meltwater coming off the ice sheet. So we know the meltwater is going in there, and we know that it's likely to be having an effect on the overturning circulation. And so it kind of seems, you know, at least consistent that in our simulations, we see a 15% reduction in the strength of the overturning, I think, you know, starting around the mid-century and only taking a few decades, which is quite kind of scary. So the question then is, you know, does 15% reduction matter? You know, we've seen a 15% reduction in strength over the last few decades. You know, if this adds to it, then we've got, you know, 30% reduction. How much further do we have to push it before we get to that collapse state? So, you know, it's an area that sparks a lot of interest and a lot of debate. And one of the reasons is, of course, because, you know, we're talking about a huge system here. I mean, we can observe sort of tiny fractions of it, but really we rely on numerical models to understand it. And, of course, the best way to understand it from a numerical model is to run lots and lots of different models and have lots of different groups doing this kind of thing. So the more that we do that, the more we get a sense of what a robust, you know, realistic response will be. So I'd say, you know, the work we've done is enough to kind of flag it as a warning.
Well, there's another warning in the paper talking about climate chaos from ice sheet melt, which is something we wouldn't normally think about. The new paper says, quote, "Perhaps more immediately impactful than gradual warming is the possibility of enhanced interannual temperature variability, which would result in more widespread or more frequent terrestrial and marine heat waves." How could the process of melting ice at the poles increase the size or frequency of heat waves in the lands where we live?
Yeah, it's difficult to sort of track these things to sort of individual events or processes. I guess what we're seeing in our climate model, which I caution is a low-resolution climate model by many standards, but essentially the picture is this, that we put the meltwater into the ocean, and that disrupts the ocean circulation close to the ice sheet. But that means that ocean circulation doesn't move the heat around the globe the way that it normally would. So when we think about sort of heat in the atmosphere, heat in the ocean, we can think of it as in this kind of constant state of flux, that heat is moving from one area to another, very much like traffic, you know, going around a roundabout or something like that. Now, as soon as you put a broken down truck in that roundabout, the flow of those cars, you know, it goes haywire, you know, and that's exactly what's happening in the ocean. We put in this melt, and then the ocean circulation kind of breaks down a little bit, or, you know, maybe that current that used to go from one place to another kind of diverts slightly, or it weakens, or it flows at a different depth. You know, these are all possible responses. And of course, the ocean is trading heat with the atmosphere. In some areas, it's taking it up. Some areas, it's releasing it. So that's why it impacts the atmosphere. The reason that we get this stop-start variability is because, you know, when it comes to the ice sheets, even though we're applying these gradual warmings, the way that the ice sheet responds is definitely not smooth and linear. The ice sheet has these episodic bursts where something happens and you get more discharge, and then it maybe finds a place where it can stabilize, so discharge slows down, and then we get more acceleration when it reaches another part of sort of ocean warming or whatever. So that means the input of melt to the oceans is also episodic, and so that gives you this stop-start in the ocean circulation and really disrupts the way that the atmospheric system responds to that.
That totally makes sense. I appreciate that. Now, we're starting to wrap up here, but I have another James Hansen quote, this time from the Independent newspaper in 2017. He said, "I don't think we're going to get 4 or 5 degrees this century because we get a cooling effect from the melting ice." Is it true that melting ice could slightly slow down global warming despite our greenhouse gas emissions?
Absolutely. And there was a paper in Nature last year by Ben Bronsalar and others where they highlighted basically the same effect that we talk about. And they were looking particularly at the impact of Antarctic ice sheet melt, whereas we've looked at Antarctic and Greenland. But yes, essentially what we find and what they find is that we might have an overall reduction in global warming under an RCP 8.5 type scenario of around 0.3 of a degree. So to put that in context, that's something a little less than 10%. So we might reduce the overall amount of warming by, you know, maybe 8% or something like that. The problem is that, of course, those changes will be spatially variable. So in some areas close to where the meltwater is going into the oceans, you'll see much larger reductions in air temperature or reduced warming, more to the point. Whereas in other areas, you'll see actually enhanced warming. And this comes back to what we were saying before about the disrupted ocean circulations. So one thing that we sort of tried to map out in the paper was just which areas were going to see enhanced warming and which areas would see slightly mollified warming. And yeah, I mean, it certainly gives you a very interesting sense of where the winners and losers are. And unfortunately, it looks like some of the enhanced warming would be around sort of eastern Canada, into the Arctic, a little bit in Central America because of the slowdown of the Gulf Stream. You know, a lot more of the heat is trapped down there. Northwest Europe would have slightly reduced warming because the heat transport across the North Atlantic basically reduces. So yeah, winners and losers. And, again, I would just say that this is one model simulation. And what we really need are, you know, lots more simulations that are doing this kind of thing to really refine our sense of where these extra warmings are going to be and where the reduced warmings are going to be.
Well, as we wrap up, can you just briefly give us a hint of what you might be working on next?
Well, what we're actively working on at the moment is trying to do a more robust job in terms of coupling our ice sheet simulations to climate models. So we made a start in this paper in terms of just sort of taking a two-way interaction between the ice sheet and the climate models. But we need to do that in a way that captures much shorter term changes. So rather than running one model, taking the outputs, putting them into another, running that model, and then kind of iterating like that, we need to be exchanging outputs from the two models, you know, much more frequently during the simulations. It's computationally a lot more intensive to do that. It's a lot more difficult to do it. It takes a bit of time to kind of get that right, but that's definitely where we need to go. And, you know, a lot of this comes back to the point that you raised earlier about, you know, what thing is driving what other thing. You know, we need to understand more fully how these different interactions work, how the feedbacks work, and really, you know, coupled models are the only way to do that.
Well, we'll send you a football-sized server farm and see what you can do with that. From the Antarctic Research Center at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, we've been speaking with Dr. Nicholas Golich. He's part of two papers just published in Nature. They are Revisiting Antarctic Ice Loss Due to Marine Ice Cliff Instability and global environmental consequences of 21st century ice sheet melt. You can find links to both and other supporting papers and articles, including Paul Beckwith's video on all this, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Nick, I know you've been swamped. Thank you for coming through for our Radio EcoShock listeners.
No problem at all. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Thank you for keeping up with the latest on Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about your world.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
It's really dismaying to me as someone who's been a reporter, been in media, to learn about the extent of how much is being covered up and then how much disinformation is being pumped out at the same time.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. Asa Winstanley is my co-host. Asa, how are you?
I'm very good.
We have a really great show coming up. This is episode 2 of our revamped Electronic Intifada podcast. In a few minutes, we'll go to this interview that we did a couple weeks ago with our friend of the show, Max Blumenthal. But we wanted to first update the situation so that we have a little bit more newsy information going into this interview, but also just kind of talk about why we brought Max on and what the bulk of his interview is, kind of getting into the weeds of this organization called the Integrity Initiative, which we kind of touched on very briefly during the first episode last week. But he's done a lot of research into what the Integrity Initiative is, its connection to, like, you know, as a very right wing think tank, the connection to Israel lobby, and also this manufactured crisis of so-called anti-Semitism in the UK lobby, which we talked about last time, but also kind of how it fits into how Palestine is a global issue. And on that note, the day that we recorded the interview with Max was the day that the attempted coup in Venezuela began. So what are your thoughts on, you know, now it's been a couple of weeks after this, the beginning of this coup attempt backed by the U.S. and Canada and other right-wing countries around the world. What have you been looking at in the past couple of weeks when it comes to Venezuela, and what's the connection that you see to Palestine right now?
So we talk in this interview that listeners are going to hear with Max about Venezuela, and me and him have a bit of a discussion about how Israel has aided right-wing governments across Latin America over many years, and especially going back to the 80s. And since then, as you predicted, really, Israel recognized Juan Guaido as the leader of Venezuela. So, I mean, it really kind of speaks to how Israel is a sort of leading part of this sort of right-wing global alliance. Which is really why we've covered it in this podcast. And Maduro and Chavez before him were staunch supporters of the Palestinian cause, but it goes deeper than that. Like, it's for us, it's like it's a matter of principle to support to oppose this coup attempt. Credible polling in Venezuela showing that 86% of Venezuelans oppose military intervention. Those voices are kind of ignored, you know, in the mainstream media, and in a similar way to how Palestinians are ignored. So Palestine is a global issue. And so, I mean, this is really why it's of importance to us to cover this story. And it's also why it was of importance to us to cover the Integrity Initiative story.
I mean, you know, I was actually surprised that it took Netanyahu, I think, about a week to finally come out and say, yes, we support this this regime change attempt in Venezuela, and we support this, you know, unelected right-wing opposition person as the legitimate president of Venezuela. I was surprised that it took him that long. It was also interesting over the past few days to see, you know, this very well-covered rally. You know, the mainstream corporate media here in the U.S. and I'm sure in Europe as well were showing, you know, they were completely ignoring the hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, you know, marching against U.S. intervention and against the attempted coup. But they were turning their cameras to this opposition rally over the weekend. That was sparsely attended, you could say. But there were like these humongous American flags as well as Israeli flags flying. And I thought it was, you know, just a very clear example of what happens when you have these right-wing authoritarian, you know, pro-apartheid elitist leaders of the world banding together to once again foment disruption and imperialist control over yet another Latin American country, as well as, like, you know, you see the installation of these notorious war criminals like Elliot Abrams, who helped arm and train the death squads in Guatemala in the 1980s, who was also, you know, heavily involved in trying to disrupt Palestinian movements for liberation. So this is, you know, it's all kind of, all these players are once again trying to foment discord and disruption, and being explicit about their intentions now, you know, centered around Venezuela's oil reserves. I mean, you had Marco Rubio, right, like pushing for regime change in Venezuela and clearly stating that he was excited that Exxon and Shell, I think, were the two oil companies, Chevron maybe, were going to reap profits in Venezuela. I mean, it's all you know, very well laid out on the table now.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, I saw as well Max retweeting some of the pro-intervention protests, you know, these sort of sparsely populated. And it was interesting to see that at the stage at one of them, there was a huge Israeli flag flying, which is to be expected, really, from, you know, such a right-wing opposition. But also they had, like, this weird display where they were right, flying all these different flags of, like, I don't know, countries they liked. So they had the US and the UK, but then they also had, like, flags of what they would think of as white countries. It was really, it was just like, oh, Sweden, you know, Greece, just, you know, Eastern Europe, Denmark. And it just a very strange thing, you know, and it kind of speaks to issues of racism within the Venezuelan elites, I suppose.
Well, Asa, before we go to the interview with Max, give us a quick summary again of what the Integrity Initiative is, so people aren't totally lost in the weeds here, and why it's important to focus on it right now.
So the Integrity Initiative is a British covert propaganda organization, essentially, that it, under the auspices of a kind of think tank, which was recently discovered to have been operating disinformation against the left in the UK, really, working with journalists, online propaganda. It was targeting Jeremy Corbyn for attack. Its documents were leaked, and we have a good discussion in this interview about it.
And it's under the auspices of combating Russian disinformation. They're doing their own disinformation, and it's funded by the British Defence Ministry, and it seems to have, and the Foreign Ministry as well, and it has millions of funding from the British government as involvement of British military intelligence.
All right, let's go to the interview with Max Blumenthal. Max Blumenthal is the editor at the Gray Zone Project. You can find them at grayzoneproject.com. He's also the co-host of Moderate Rebels. It's a podcast you can find wherever you listen to podcasts. He's also the author of several books, including Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, and The 51-Day War, which was about Israel's attacks on Gaza in 2014. Let's go to the interview with Max Blumenthal. Max, it's really good to have you on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Great to be on.
Let's start off by talking a little bit about what's happening in the news right now. Today we're recording on January 23rd. It looks like Venezuela is heading into a full-fledged coup. The Trump administration, Trump and Pence, as well as the Canadian government have just declared that they are recognizing the opposition leader as the president of Venezuela instead of the Nicolas Maduro, who actually won the election. This is, of course, after Netanyahu and Trump have been courting Bolsonaro in Brazil. It remains to be seen whether Netanyahu is now going to come out today with his support of the opposition leader in Venezuela. It really looks like like we are heading into a civil war there, backed by Trump and Canada. And Bolsonaro, of course, and Netanyahu, kind of this like cabal of fascist leadership, authoritarian figures all supporting each other. How do you see what's going on there? And what are your thoughts right now, today, looking at all of this?
Well, it's really remarkable to watch the Trump administration back a figure who could, Juan Guaido, who is the chair of the National Assembly, which was dissolved because it was not functioning as a parliamentary body, but basically as a means for obstructing the Bolivarian government's agenda. And it was replaced with a constituent assembly that was more broadly reflective of the public. And the Trump administration has recognized its leader as the leader of Venezuela. So basically a figure who was not elected by Venezuelans. Venezuela has had something like 12 or 10 elections. And in each case, Hugo Chavez or his successor, Maduro, has won. And, you know, we've seen consistently the U.S. step up the pressure with the Trump administration really ratcheting it up as they kind of pull out of the Middle East. I actually see this as sort of peripherally related to the pullout that Trump wants to execute in Syria, where the U.S. is sort of moving out of the war on terror, moving out of the Middle East. The Trump national security doctrine that was introduced under the outgoing defense secretary, James Mattis, or the former defense secretary, James Mattis, didn't even mention ISIS. It was all about great power conflict. And Trump is really moving more into the U.S.'s immediate sphere of influence and trying to reinforce the Monroe Doctrine. And so we've seen the passage of the NECA Act against Nicaragua, which just repelled a right-wing coup. We've seen Trump attempt to denormalize or step back from normalization with Cuba and start to reimpose sanctions on Cuba. And now we've seen, thanks to the favorable geopolitical landscape in Venezuela, the Trump administration trying to turn up the heat through, first of all, Colombia and Iván Duque, a right-wing figure who won an election. If you remember, several months ago, there was the first assassination attempt on an elected leader by drone. Drones were flown in to assassinate Nicolás Maduro at a military parade. It was unsuccessful. That assassination attempt was orchestrated from Colombia by exiled Venezuelan opposition figures. The Colombian government was told who they were and where they were, and it did nothing. Then, as you mentioned, Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right figure from Brazil, who's actually the toast of the town here in Washington, was elected. And this really enabled the Trump administration to move towards a full-scale military coup, which is what we see taking place now. Venezuela has talked about fully breaking relations with the U.S., and that coincides with or prompted the Trump administration to recognize Guaido as the leader. And if this takes place, it would actually potentially allow the U.S. to seize the assets of Citgo, which is the Venezuelan state oil company, and it's based, I think, in Houston in the U.S. So that would be a major escalation. The U.S. is trying to prevent all oil exports from Venezuela. We're starting to see some street protests in Caracas and other cities, the burning of statues of Hugo Chavez in more upscale or middle-class neighborhoods where the opposition had sort of a stronghold. And I think we're moving towards some kind of violence. We saw in 2015 the Garimbas, which were extremely violent, and they were put down. I think we could be heading into a scenario like that. But at the same time, there have been threats of military intervention. And I understand the White House just did a call with reporters and made a direct threat on the life of Nicolas Maduro. The rhetoric is really extreme. And as you mentioned, Nora, the Canadian government has also endorsed Juan Guaido as the leader of the official leader of Venezuela. So, you know, nice sock wearing, handsome boy modeling school graduate Justin Trudeau is joining the Trump administration in what is effectively a putsch against a socialist oriented government. One last point, just because you brought up Israel and Bolsonaro. Yeah, it's very true that Netanyahu has a special relationship with Bolsonaro. A lot of this has to do, and actually there's, Bolsonaro gave a speech at the Hebrew Club when he was campaigning, which was protested by some, I would say, left Zionist Brazilian Jews outside who were affiliated with the youth group of Hashomer Hatzair, which was very close to the original labor founding wing of the State of Israel. And in that speech, Bolsonaro stood in front of an Israeli flag and really positioned himself as the defender of Israel from within Brazil, a country where the population largely doesn't support Israel, but increasingly is supporting Israel because of a concerted attempt to implant Pentecostalism, evangelical Pentecostalism, in Brazil as a form of counterinsurgency. It actually started through funding from the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation in the 1970s to fund the expansion of the World Church of the Creator, I think it's called. And this church is led by someone whose name I'm forgetting right now, who's one of the kingmakers now in Brazilian politics. And it's that evangelical Pentecostal influence that provides a real basis for the kind of right-wing, pro-American, pro-NATO, and pro-Israel government that Bolsonaro represents. And that is not present in Venezuela. It's not present at all in a place like Nicaragua or in Mexico, where I recently witnessed the inauguration of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is sort of a social democratic figure who is pledging reconciliation with the indigenous population of Mexico, while Bolsonaro is actually kind of calling to wipe out pro-indigenous organizations. So that's a really interesting factor here, is the evangelical Christian right influence.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elliot Mintzberg of the group People for the American Way, who examines the constitutionality of President Trump's declaration of a national emergency he's using to bypass Congress to secure funding for his U.S.-Mexico border wall. Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, who talks about why he believes Bernie Sanders, now making his second run for the White House, remains the authentic progressive in a growing field of Democratic candidates. And Amy Griffin, associate head coach at the University of Washington, who explains why she believes there's a link between artificial turf crumb rubber athletic fields and cancer. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While the Trump White House has imposed harsh economic sanctions and threatened military intervention to depose Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in favor of opposition leader Juan Guaido, the U.S. government has slammed the door shut on refugees fleeing Venezuela's economic and political crisis. According to the American Prospect, the Trump administration has deported more Venezuelans in the past few months than it has resettled Venezuelan refugees in years. In October and November of last year alone, immigration officials deported more than 120 Venezuelan nationals. Meanwhile, the U.S. has not resettled a single Venezuelan refugee since 2013, nor does it have any plans to do so in the near future. Despite the crisis in Venezuela, immigration judges in the U.S. have denied roughly 50% of all asylum applications made by Venezuelans over the past five fiscal years. Adriana Kostenki, head of the Venezuelan American National Bar Association, accused the Trump administration of being hypocritical. Since becoming president, Trump has slashed overall refugee admissions into the U.S. by two-thirds and ended temporary protected status for people fleeing violence and repression in Haiti, El Salvador, and Sudan. Forces loyal to Libya's eastern leader Khalifa Haftar have taken control of al-Sharara, the country's largest oil field. Haftar's self-styled Libyan National Army drove out armed groups who had closed down the 300,000-barrel-per-day facility in December, demanding more money and investment in the remote region. Haftar's forces pledged earlier to hand the field over to the National Oil Corporation once it was fully secured. Since the ouster of authoritarian leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, Libya has been engaged in a bloody civil war between rival militia groups. The United Nations plans to convene a national peace conference, possibly in March, bringing together the interim government and multiple rebel factions. It is hoped that the talks will lead to either parliamentary or presidential elections and a new constitution. The UN is still trying to win an agreement by those attending the meeting for a broad agenda. The head of Libya's state-owned oil company said he wants to organize a national armed force to protect the country's petroleum assets after repeated seizures by militia groups. Mustafa Sanalla, chairman of the National Oil Corporation, said his plan for a national non-tribal oil installation protection force should start with a pilot project in al-Sharara once it was secured. 3 years ago, Chicago community activists shook the city's political establishment when voters ousted Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez in a primary over widespread outrage over the police killing of Laquan McDonald. Mayor Rahm Emanuel, tarnished by the McDonald killing and his delay in releasing the police video of the shooting, won't run for a third term, creating a historic opportunity for progressives to sweep out Chicago's entrenched old guard in City Hall. 14 candidates are running for mayor in the first round of elections on February 26th. Top candidates include Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle and community organizer Amara Enya, both running on progressive platforms. In These Times magazine reports, progressive candidates are pledging to reopen mental health clinics, invest in schools, and shake up Chicago's scandal-ridden police department. The left-leaning Chicago Teachers Union endorsed Preckwinkle on her pledge to establish an elected school board and impose a moratorium on school closings, charter school expansion, and school privatization. The Chicago establishment is backing candidates such as former Obama Chief of Staff Bill Daley and businessman Willie Wilson. What is different in 2019 is the level of mobilization by grassroots activists to defeat Chicago's entrenched Democratic Party machine. Amisha Patel, director of the Grassroots Collaborative, maintained, "The number one reason we have this electoral moment is absolutely the organizing of young black people responding to massive police brutality." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
President Trump, pivoting off his surrender to Congress's refusal to allocate the $5.7 billion he demanded to build his southern border wall, declared a national emergency on February 15th. As the White House telegraphed for weeks, the emergency declaration was a desperate ploy to bypass Congress to take money allocated for other purposes to fund the U.S.-Mexico border wall Trump pledged to construct during his 2016 election campaign. In a disjointed speech made in the White House Rose Garden, Trump repeated his standard lies about the need for a border wall to address what he falsely claims to be a national security threat of violent crime committed by immigrants and to stop a flood of illegal drugs entering the U.S. from Mexico. MoveOn.org and a coalition of groups across the U.S. organized protests in 48 states on February 18th that attracted the participation of at least 50,000 people demonstrating their opposition to Trump's emergency declaration. In addition to proposed legislation to overturn Trump's move to divert funds for the wall, now making its way through Congress, 16 states have filed a federal lawsuit challenging the national emergency declaration, which will likely be heard by the Supreme Court during the 2020 election campaign. Your reporter spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way, who examines the constitutionality of President Trump's declaration of a national emergency to get his wall and the possible long-term damage to the rule of law and democracy.
We're firmly opposed to it and believe that it is an astonishing power grab, even more astonishing than what Trump has done already, that violates not only the National Emergencies Act, but the Constitution itself in its attempt to literally and unilaterally override a decision by Congress, Republicans and Democrats, by the way, not to give Trump the money he wants for this border wall.
Just in terms of the constitutionality of Trump's emergency declaration, maybe you could explain a bit to our audience about provisions within the United States government for a president to invoke emergency powers. What has been the norm until this move by Trump, and what we can expect in terms of constitutional challenges to what he's done here?
Sure. They're both constitutional and statutory. The major authority for a president to declare a national emergency is from the National Emergencies Act passed by Congress, which gives a president fairly broad discretion in figuring out what an emergency is, but has a couple of very important limitations that I hope will be very important. First, there are limits on what purposes that you can use a national emergency to justify spending that hasn't been authorized by Congress. And we think it's very clear that those limits have been breached by the plans as announced by Trump and the White House, and that even if, by some incredible stretch, one considered this an emergency in any sense of the word, he doesn't have the statutory authority to spend these billions of dollars on the wall that he wants to spend it on. But the other thing that the National Emergencies Act does is provides at least some element of check and balance with the legislative branch. what can happen under the act, and it's already underway in the House. One House can pass a resolution that essentially condemns the National Emergency Declaration and tries to revoke it, says, no, there really is no such emergency. We don't agree with the president. And if the House passes that, as we expect it will, then the Senate, by law, has 15 days to vote yea or nay on the Senate floor. No filibuster, no delay, gotta happen. And that's the critical vote where Republican as well as Democratic votes need to stand up and be counted. If both houses rebuke President Trump, he still can veto that, unfortunately, and it will take a large majority, two-thirds, to override that veto, but that's still possible. If there's enough citizen activism around the country from people pressuring both Democratic and Republican legislators to essentially revoke his astonishing emergency declaration. If that doesn't work, then I think the courts are our major alternative, which I'm happy to discuss.
In your view, what is the long-term damage to our democracy and the role of Congress as an independent branch of government in our Constitution if this emergency declaration is let to stand?
If Trump gets away with this, he and future presidents can effectively become dictators in the United States. What does a foreign dictator do? Usually, they go to their alleged Congress before they do something. And if Congress doesn't give them what they want, they do it anyway. That's exactly what Trump is trying to do now. And that kind of action by Trump, if not checked by Congress and by the courts, could lead America to going right down that road. And indeed, there are many Republicans who worry that future Democratic presidents may use this to justify unilateral action on climate change or on gun control, causes that I personally believe in quite strongly, but do believe that in our democracy have to involve both the president and the Congress in taking action.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way. Find more commentary on Trump's emergency declaration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As expected, 77-year-old independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders joined the already crowded field of Democratic candidates vying to be the party's presidential nominee in the 2020 election. Sanders, who defied conventional wisdom with his unexpectedly strong run against Hillary Clinton in the 2016 Democratic primary, is credited with moving the party to the left on a host of issues he championed in his earlier campaign. His advocacy of universal health care through Medicare for All, moving to a national $15 minimum wage, and tuition-free public college have become mainstream positions among most of the 12 Democratic candidates who've already launched their campaigns. A recent Morning Consult poll found that among Democratic primary voters nationwide and in early voting states, former Vice President Joe Biden led the pack, followed by Sanders, California Senator Kamala Harris, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and a California Sanders delegate to the 2016 Democratic National Convention. He's currently a coordinator of the recently relaunched Bernie Delegates Network. Here Solomon addresses recent criticisms leveled at Sanders regarding sexual harassment claims during the 2016 campaign and his relationship with the nation's black community, while maintaining that Bernie remains the authentic progressive voice in a growing field of Democratic candidates.
On the surface, there is a lot of cohesion and willingness to say what Bernie has been saying for years, actually decades, for instance, about the need for Medicare for All, the need for free public college education, the need to see human rights in economic terms as rights, not privileges, the right to a job, an opportunity, not just an opportunity, but a reality. So on the surface, a lot of these candidates have been understanding that there is a progressive undertow and wave that has swept this country very visibly in the last couple of years since the 2016 election, and they don't want to be left behind. In baseball terms, they don't want to be leaning the wrong way on the base paths and get picked off. They're trying to win. They want to be with the current zeitgeist. But what's different about Bernie? He's not on the surface. He hasn't just been saying these things for a few months or a year or two. This has been his entire political career and, indeed, his activist work before that. So people really are going to be faced with the choice of whether they're going to go for candidates that put on the fashion clothes of this particular historic moment or whether they're going to go for the real deal.
And I wondered if you would comment, Norman, on a flurry of recent attacks on Bernie Sanders, including accusations he didn't do enough to address sexual harassment, allegations made against some of his 2016 campaign staff. There was also a recent New York Times story on Bernie's, as they termed it, troubled relationship with the African-American community in this country during his 2016 campaign. It seems to be a feature of presidential campaign coverage in 2020 that Bernie's on the receiving end of a lot of barbs here.
To put this in context, when Bernie ran for president, announced and began running in 2015, first he was ignored and disparaged by the news media. It was predicted by some he would barely, if at all, get out of single digits in the primaries. And when from the grassroots the campaign gathered momentum, there were ferocious attacks from the corporate mass media. The Media Watch Group FAIR, where I'm an associate, released a study at the time of the Michigan primary. This is when Bernie was really, really gaining momentum. And on the eve of that very decisive primary, which he, by surprising the pundits, actually won, the Washington Post published 16 negative stories about Bernie in 16 hours. Not in 16 weeks or 16 days, but 16 hours, 16 negative stories by the Washington Post. And that just tells you the ferocity of some of the major media hostility towards Bernie. Now, is it a coincidence that the owner of the Washington Post is the richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos, who also owns, as well as the Post, Amazon and Whole Foods and so forth? Bernie has been campaigning against the oligarchy. So that said, certainly this is not a justification, but just an explanation. Every large campaign has some really bad things that go on with thousands and thousands of volunteers and supervisors. And clearly, Bernie Sanders should have done a better job of making sure that to the maximum extent possible, there were strict rules that were conveyed to volunteers and supervisors and employees about sexual harassment. And we have to hope, and we're certainly advocating for him to do a much better job as the candidate in that way, as he has said he will. In terms of African-American voters, there's no doubt that Hillary Clinton simply crushed Bernie in the South among African-American voters fairly early on in the campaign. But it's also true, according to exit polls and public opinion polls, that by the end of the primary season, Bernie had more support among African-American young people than Hillary Clinton did. And what we didn't get from the recent New York Times very high-profile story is the fact that a recent CNN poll showed that among people of color, Bernie is the most, not the second or third, but the most favored candidate for president for 2020. So it all depends, unfortunately, on how it's spun. And Bernie has had a lot of hills to climb going from a Vermont senator to a presidential candidate. I think that this campaign is going to have a lot of momentum. I have no idea whether he'll be the nominee, but I think he has a great shot at it. I think that what we're seeing is some real public discourse and label shifting, and it's hard to know how that will sift out. But I would say this. When we have a lot of candidates running for president who have been shifting their policies with the wind, going the way the wind seems to be blowing, when they perceive the wind shifting, perhaps after getting the nomination, they could easily, in character, shift back in another direction. Bernie doesn't blow with the wind and shift with the wind, he has helped to create a progressive wind, and that is a very big difference. It's crucial that Trump be defeated, or if Trump doesn't run, that Pence or some other Republican who does run in 2020, that person has to be defeated. Bernie has as good a chance, at least according to polling, to defeat the Republican in 2020 as any other prospective nominee of the party. So let's go with what we believe in instead of going with fairly hollow candidates.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and a coordinator of the recently relaunched Bernie Delegates Network. Find more analysis and commentary on Bernie Sanders' 2020 candidacy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Amy Griffin, associate head coach at the University of Washington, has worked with the same demographic of students for 24 years. She never knew a soccer player who had cancer until 2009. What began as a list of two goalkeepers with cancer that year has now grown to a list of 260 players from various sports, but most are soccer players, and goalkeepers make up 59% of the total. Although Coach Griffin acknowledges that correlation is not causation, the rising incidence of cancers has occurred as more and more athletic playing fields of natural grass have been replaced with artificial turf fields made of crumb rubber infill produced from ground-up recycled tires. Goalkeepers among all soccer players have the most contact with the crumb rubber. In early February, Griffin, an award-winning soccer coach, spoke at a forum sponsored by the Yale University School of Public Health. She shared with the audience data she's collected on the incidence of cancer among players she's coached over the years. Recognizing that while she's not a scientist, Griffin is urging the scientific and public health community to thoroughly research the possible link between artificial turf fields made of crumb rubber and cancer.
EPA, they're in charge of keeping us safe from environmental factors. They were the ones that said, you know what, these tires are toxic, so you can't throw them away, and you can't burn them, and you can't bury them. You can't. It's illegal. We're going to have a tax on these tires so that we can afford to collect them in a safe way and get them out of the environment and make sure that you don't do anything stupid with them, and we'll keep them for you. But that added another problem onto their list. What do you think happened to all the places where they were collecting them? They were overflowing with tires. They have nowhere to put these really unsafe, really toxic, dangerous things. So they actually ended up sponsoring the growth of crumb rubber to solve their waste challenge. So the government actually subsidizes communities that use crumb rubber fields. So in the state of California, I don't know, 5 years ago, $6.1 million went to help the parks and recreational facilities in California because it was helping their waste problem, right? We were recycling these tires and we were breaking them up into millions of pieces and getting them out in our community so that our kids are playing on trash. And then there's the RCRA law. So it's the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. And basically it's in charge of ensuring that we manage our waste in environmentally safe and sound ways, which is why you couldn't take a tire out because it's toxic waste. But what's not regulated is if you turn it into a different product. If you turn it into a different product, and now it's no longer a tire, it doesn't follow the same regulations. So then what's crazy is they have very short lifespans, right? So these fields, they took them out of the dump, and now they're like, wait, they have to be hauled back into the dump again because the fields only last 6 to 10 years. So now they're stuck with the same problem they had to begin with, only worse is because these are chopped up into millions and millions of little pieces, and there's no net waste gain. Now, you know, 5% of these fields every year disappears into the waterways and into our shoes. So now the chemical leaching from fields, the EPA doesn't really treat it as a point source, so therefore it's not monitored. And so the runoff just goes into your rivers and your lakes and your coasts basically. And there's no regulation as to where it's disposed. So my list of athletes continued to grow. So at 9, I started writing it on a yellow notepad, okay? So, and then the list of 9 grew to 35, grew to 50, grew to 75, and now, as of a couple days ago, it's at 260. Remember, in order to get on this list, you have to have heard a story, seen an article, taken the time to find my name and number, and then get on the list, okay? So, anecdotal. It's just a list. It's my research. Okay. I haven't ever deleted anyone from the list, so some of them play other sports. We're now at 119 goalkeepers, and that's 59% of the people on my list. That percentage has always been between 59 and 61%. It has never changed as the numbers have grown. All right, so what does the data show? Okay, that data shows, in my mind, absolutely nothing. This is why you guys are here. This is why you guys are listening. I know that correlation does not equal causation. I have learned that. So I've got these numbers, and some of them, there's some red flags to me. There's some things that make me really, really concerned. Three of the Hodgkin lymphoma were age 14, diagnosed at 14, and they were diagnosed at stage 4, which apparently is really, really rare. And these are the blood-related cancers, which I've been told have been tied to an environmental association of some sort or another. And then here are some of the others that are on my list. The median age for thyroid cancer is 39. This is based on the American Cancer Society. Diagnosed between the age of 0 to 20, there's a chance that happens 1.9%. And 10 of the 11 were diagnosed between the ages of 16 and 26. Also, the ovarian cancer, I think it's very concerning that the ages are 14, 15, 23, and 24. Very rare in people under the age of 40. The median age is 63. And then the lung cancer, 100% of them goalkeepers. All three diagnosed at the age of 19, 26, and 27. None of them were smokers. So that's the data that everyone's talking about. And the reason I think this has become a story and the reason I think that I'm here, if there is a reason, is that for every statistic that scientists and toxicologists are working on, I have a human face to attach to this. And it's these people's stories and their deaths and their concerns that have made this very interesting.
That was University of Washington soccer coach Amy Griffin. Learn more about the possible link between artificial turf athletic fields made of crumb rubber and cancer by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, Global Community Radio in Geneva, New York, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
You're at the People's Forum in Manhattan. It's Organization Movement Central. And you are the man of the hour right now. I'm going to pass you over to Robin Spencer, Dr. Robin Spencer, who's the host tonight.
Very well. Thank you.
Wonderful. Welcome, Mumia. We're so happy to hear from you this afternoon.
Thank you, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. I want to describe the scene maybe since you're not here with us yet.
Okay.
There are about 80 of us in here from all walks of life. We have come in from the cold New York winter on a frigid day with Donald Trump as president of these United States. And we are here to hear more about your freedom, dreams, and the struggle and how we can support you.
Excellent, excellent. Well, what you're doing today, despite this Arctic cold we're experiencing, it's a damn good beginning because the solution to repression and oppression is organization and movement building. Those are the only real solutions. When people get together and organize and fight, that's when change happens. When they don't do that is when repression happens. You know, we need to think about this in fundamental ways, about force and counterforce, about repression and struggle against that. And I think it was Frederick Douglass who said, without struggle, there is no progress.
Yes, right on, right on.
So, you know, you're doing what you're doing, and you're doing what needs to be done, because it seems to me that most of the people here are activists and organizers. Well, I'm going to, again, quote a great black leader. This is Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, who wrote the book Black Power. Organize, organize, organize. He ended every speech he ever gave in his adulthood with those words. And we must learn from that.
Definitely. Well, we're here today in particular to find out about new developments in your case. We want to be informed so we can take the word back to the movements and communities that we're accountable for. How are you feeling now with the potential of the doors opening?
Well, you know, I think I probably joked about this, but it's not a joke because, damn it, it ain't funny. But this was probably the first time I've been before a state judge of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania who was not paid by the FOP. And that means something, you know. I want that to settle in your minds. He was a former life member of the FOP. And we know from the appeals from his decisions that we went to the Supreme Court and we complained about a man who would be later the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. We said he should remove himself and recuse himself. He said, well, if taking money from the FOP disqualified me from sitting here, then what about all the justices around me? At least four of them took money from the FOP, including me. I didn't know that until he wrote that in his opinion, rejecting our call. But I was like, damn, well, maybe all of you need to remove yourself.
Yes.
But all of them were paid by the FOP because they said so. So, you know, the newest developments come from a judge who hears and decided based on what he heard as opposed to the kind of money that was being slipped into his pocket. And that's a new development.
Definitely. And I want to say that we are in a room full of people who are long-distance runners in the movement to free political prisoners and prisoners of war. So I want to acknowledge Pam Africa from the Concerned Friends and Family of Mumia, Johanna Fernandez. We have Glenn Ford with us today, who's going to bring the word of radical journalism to us. I also want to acknowledge
that
we are in the People's Forum. We are in the People's Forum. So we have one of the organizers of this space, Manolo, to come and share some words with you and welcome you. Dr. Joseph Harris wants you to know that he's in the house.
Dr. Joseph Harris, yes, right. Well, Pam Africa, Glenn Ford, all of you, welcome. Thank you. On the move.
Well, we Herb Boyd. All right. Well, we want to just say to Mumia and to all our comrades who are here today that doing this activity today is part of the long-term commitment that the People's Forum and our collective have to the liberation of our people. We're not doing this because we just want to defend Mumia. We do this because we believe in the same liberation process that Mumia believes in. And this is not a struggle for today, but a struggle for all our lives. When Mumia is out, we will be happy to receive him here for the ongoing party, but also for the continuing work transforming our society. Thank you for having us here.
Well said, sir. Well said. Thank you. You're absolutely correct. The movement is, you know, a lifetime movement. I don't think I really understood that when I was 15 and in the Black Panther Party, but, you know, life presents opportunities to us, and life teaches us. And, you know, to quote the late Kilu Niasha, a Black Panther from New Haven who transplanted to California and spent her most of her life in California, freedom is a constant struggle.
Ujima, this is Dante S. Mitchell, better known as Mfaume Sikivu, reporting to you from Great Meadow Correctional Facility in Comstock, New York. I know this guy incarcerated with me named Chris. He's a white guy I met in the law library. He's a clerk there who has helped me a few times with things I needed done, mostly involving my efforts to reach young prisoners with my UFD message. Chris came to prison as a kid after making a series of unfortunate choices. He's now 45 years old and may potentially spend the rest of his life in prison. You would think, after looking at his rap sheet, that this man is a monster. But when you delve deeper into his circumstances and see what he has accomplished on his own in his self-development, you become hard-pressed to maintain that opinion. I was talking to Chris the other day, and he said something that was profound and that puts the lie to the idea of retribution as a central goal of imprisonment. Chris said, and I quote, "I'm faced with the real possibility that I may die in prison. So the idea of rehabilitation means nothing to me. But I do all the things I am doing to improve and better myself because, one, I take full responsibility for the quality of my life under my current circumstances. And two, I live my life as if every day is my last," end quote. Chris has accomplished a lot since he finally committed to change and betterment. He's completed every mandatory drug treatment and anger regression training program. He's earned a paralegal certificate and an associate's degree in Latin and liberal arts and humanities with honors, and he's earned even more college credits and is currently enrolled in the Bennington College program here at Great Meadow. Chris was an honor block and participated successfully in the family reunion program. Both honor block and the family reunion program were designed to encourage and reward prisoners for good behavior and for successfully completing mandatory programs. The family reunion program has proven to have a positive impact on prisoners, as it allows prisoners to spend time on a trailer 3 days with their family or their wife. Despite this, after the Clinton escape in 2015, docs removed Chris and all prisoners with an escape in their past from on the block in the family reunion program. This decision had no rational basis and sound prison management. It was a face-saving move. Docs decided to punish a whole category of prisoners for the wrongful acts of two other prisoners who had no history of escape until they actually did. What all this revealed is that DOCSIS culture, perpetuated by high-level departmental staff, is that regardless of what a prisoner accomplishes, he can never rise above his or her past. Somehow we're destined to be failures. This calls into question whether DOCSIS' mandate to correct criminal behavior is merely for show. Does DOCS really believe in its programs they purport are to reform prisoners? There are correction staff who believe most prisoners are animals who are better off getting old in prison and dying. How can such people be trusted to correct criminal behavior when they don't believe it's possible? Prisoners like myself and Chris prove that even violent offenders can be reformed and rehabilitated. But we had to do this on our own because, as in Chris's case with being removed from honor block in the family reunion program, and in my case with me still waiting on clemency, DOCS isn't committed to our growth and development. How then does DOCS hope to improve prison behavior when it limits our prospects to improve ourselves by denying us things worth living and doing good for? Tune in next time for more. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Free Dante Mitchell. Share your questions and comments. Thank you for listening. God bless.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Are legitimate criticisms leveled against the Trump administration distracting from vital conversations about systemic and structural racism in the United States? How significantly has an appeal of a Philadelphia court judge's ruling by a supposedly progressive district attorney set back the campaign to free Mumia Abu-Jamal? What do members of the Move 9 remember about the day Philadelphia police swarmed and raided their communal home in August of 1978? What significant changes have they discovered in the world more than 40 years after their unjust incarceration for the murder of a police officer? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we mark Black History Month with three provocative interviews relating to racial injustice in the United States. We first get an overview of what resistance looks like 2 years into the Trump administration from radio host and commentator Glenn Ford. We next get an update on a dramatic turn in the case of America's most high-profile political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Finally, we get an exclusive interview with two members of the Move 9 and their son about their ordeal at the hands of the system and their recent release after 4 decades in jail. On today's program, Black History Month special, Trump-era resistance, Mumia's plight, and freedom for the Move 9. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 22, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Since Paul Martin's Liberals played an important role in violently ousting Jean-Bertrand Aristide's government in 2004, Canada has financed, trained, and overseen the Haitian National Police. As took place the night Aristide was forced out of the country by U.S. Marines, Canadian troops were recently photographed patrolling the Port-au-Prince airport. Taking their cue from Ottawa, the dominant media have downplayed the scope of the recent protests and repression in Haiti. There have been few, any, stories about protesters
putting their bodies on the line for freedom and the greater good. Instead, the media has focused on the difficulties faced by a small number of Canadian tourists, missionaries, and aid workers. That comes from the article, Canadian Policy on Venezuela, Haiti Reveals Hypocrisy That Media Ignores, by Eve Engler, posted February 20th, originally appearing at the author's blog, eveengler.com. Venezuelan authorities have expelled six deputies of the European Parliament, or EP, this Sunday after denying them entrance to the country. The European politicians who traveled in a personal capacity had previously been warned through diplomatic channels that they would not be allowed in the country, but the group opted to proceed with the trip. The delegation was made up of MEP Esteban González Pons, MEP José Ignacio Salafranca, and MEP Gabriel Mato, all from Spain's hard-right Popular Party. Also present were MEP Juan Salafranca from Spain's European People's Party, MEP Esther de Lange of the Dutch Christian Democratic Party, and MEP Paulo Rangel from Portugal's Social Democratic Party. Amongst other planned activities, they were to meet with self-proclaimed interim president Juan Guaido while in Caracas. That comes from the article, Venezuela Expels Euro Deputies Amid Reports of Talks with Washington, by Paul Dobson. Posted February 20th, originally published at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. The Duma attack was not the first and only case when studio work was presented by the U.S.-led bloc as a decisive evidence justifying its actions in the conflict. After the April 2017 attack in Khan Sheikhoun, experts voiced concern that the video released by the White Helmets as a proof of the chemical attack conducted by the Assad regime was staged. In fact, weaponized disinformation campaigns, staged videos, and fake news are common approaches used by the U.S. military and special services to promote their own agenda around the world. The U.S. was actively using these tools during its intervention in Iraq and after it. According to the later revelations, the employed programs were varying from placing Pentagon-provided articles in Iraqi newspapers as quote-unquote unbiased news to producing footage, which were made to look as if they had been, quote, created by Arabic TV, unquote, and CDs with fake Al-Qaeda videos, which then distributed through various channels. That comes from the article appearing under the headline, Video, Staged Chemical Attack Videos and Other Trends in Modern Propaganda, posted February 20th, originally published at South Front. CJPME points out that while the Jewish community is often portrayed as staunchly pro-Israel, Jewish opinion on Israel is much more wide-ranging, as more than a third or 37% of Jewish Canadians hold a negative opinion of the Israeli government. While our Canadian politicians continue to argue that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, the majority of Jewish Canadians themselves, or 58%, do not believe criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. Moreover, nearly a third of Jewish Canadians, or 30%, believe that the Palestinian call for a boycott of Israel is reasonable, condemning the Canadian government's 2016 motion to denounce human rights activists who endorse a boycott of Israel. In fact, nearly half of Jewish Canadian participants, or 48%, recognize that accusations of anti-Semitism are often leveraged to silence legitimate criticism of Israeli government policies. CJPME notes that a 2017 survey sponsored by CJPME and IJV revealed that Canadian government policy on Israel is not representative of most Canadians' views. That comes from the article, Survey Reveals Many Jewish Canadians Critical of Israel, by Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, posted February 20th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. While there's much to condemn about the current occupant of the White House and his policies, racial injustice in the modern era did not begin with the arrival of Make America Great Again. To review the progress or lack thereof for the black reality in America 2 years into the post-Obama era, we're joined by Glenn Ford,
Glenn Ford is a distinguished radio show host and commentator. In 1977, Ford co-launched, produced, and hosted America's Black Forum, the first nationally syndicated black news interview program on commercial television. Ford co-founded the Black Commentator in 2002 and launched the Black Agenda Report in 2006, where he continues to serve as executive editor. Ford is also the author of The Big Lie, an analysis of the U.S. media coverage of the Grenada invasion. Glenn Ford, welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour.
Thanks for inviting me.
You've been outspoken about the failures of the Obama administration, noting, for example, that mass deportations of illegal immigrants did not begin with Trump. Without soft-pedaling those failures, to what extent would you say racial injustice and inequality has worsened under Trump?
Oh, I'm sure that with Trump in the White House, that the racist cops everywhere feel that they have a friend, and he's assured them over and over again that he is that friend. And we remember, of course, on the campaign trail, Trump was urging police not to be so gentle with people they had in custody. So in terms of moral support for racism among the folks that least need it, which are the cops in the United States, Trump that does make a difference.
It's been noted that on this program that Trump at least had the virtue of being a more honest symbol of the violence, xenophobia, misogyny, and racism inherent within the United States system. Do you have concerns about the hostility that we've seen among progressives directed primarily at Trump, distracting the public from more fundamental, structural, and systemic problems?
Yeah, that is, in fact, the other side of the coin. Everybody and their mother is now an anti-racist. I've never seen such a verbally non-racist country. But, of course, that's an illusion and a diversion. We see, for example, that Chicago brags that it's a sanctuary city. Well, they're talking about Chicago's policies with regard to undocumented people. But, of course, Chicago has never been a sanctuary city for black people. It's one of the most racist cities in the country. But people in Chicago, the powers that be, the Democrats that be in Chicago, can claim that they're anti-Trump, and, of course, they're anti-racist, and they're a sanctuary city, but not a damn thing's changed on the ground.
We've been seeing efforts at the national level to get involved with the political process and elect progressive Democrats, say Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ilhan Omar, women of color in particular to high office. What are your thoughts? Are these worthy, if limited, endeavors? A complete waste of time, or worse, possibly a distraction from more fundamental strategies for addressing the injustices and inequalities of our time?
Well, the Democratic Party is in the business of distraction. They are experts at it. But in that process, certain social forces are at work, and real, genuine protest, real, genuine politics can break through. I'm not ready to call Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez a distraction. I don't think that the publicity that she's given to the idea of a Green New Deal is distractive. And even if folks mean to be distractive, they can often set in motion a conversation that they can't control. I don't think that she is a socialist, nor is Bernie Sanders. But when you start saying that you're a socialist and you put the term in the general conversation, well, some folks will actually get around to learning what socialism really is, and so that's a productive conversation. So that doesn't bother me. I'm glad the conversation is occurring.
Well, what about the phenomenon of mass incarceration? Because I think that like slowly we're starting to see an evolution of the discussion around crime and punishment and recognition that mass incarceration is a tool, an extremely racialized tool of ongoing repression. I mean, you know, through the prison industrial complex, more black people are slaves today than there were in the 19th century. So do you see that reality starting to percolate through and get addressed in a fundamental way, or is that still pretty much off the you know, outside of the view of modern activists?
Well, the conversation, the mass awareness now of mass black incarceration is in fact the brightest light that's been shining on us in probably the last two or three generations. It's the only arena in which we had the semblance of a movement after having no mass movements since the 1960s. So that's the bright light. Mass black incarceration is now on everyone's lips. And that, I think mass black incarceration and gentrification are the two biggest challenges facing black America. Gentrification is also now part of the dialogue surrounding this Green New Deal, this massive remake of American economy, which means a remake of the society. Gentrification is top on the list, not necessarily because of what it's done to black folks, but because there has to be a reworking of how folks live if we're going to adjust to the new climate realities.
And the role of media, are we seeing backward forces that are undermining authentic struggle?
You know, I came to professional maturity in the golden age of black radio, when there were newscasters at every black-oriented radio station, to the extent that in Washington, D.C., just three black-oriented radio stations fielded 21 reporters. That was the golden age. That's the age that many of us thought that we were bringing information for liberation to the people, but it didn't last long. And the consolidation of media in just a decade or two wound up wiping out radio news all over the country, not just in black radio. And we'd already seen the demise of black print media. And then we saw that whatever contribution television made to black awareness and to progressive awareness in general went away as well. And we saw finally, in 1996, with the Clinton administration's and the FCC, their FCC's final blow to independent radio, the near total consolidation under corporate control of the radio waves. And then, late after that, we saw how the FCC and the executive branch basically gave away the signals to television when television went to cable and sold them off, sold those signals off to private contractors, private companies, instead of splitting up those signals and creating a whole new universe of television stations that could have gone to black folks and Hispanics and people who don't have conventional politics. So now there's almost total hegemony of the airwaves and the big circulation print media by the corporations. And it's even gone further than that in the last 2 years with Russiagate, so that we now have fact checkers and vigilantes who are actually closely connected to the national security state, who are scouring social media for signs of political disruption that is supposedly directed by Russians. But what they're looking really to root out is dissent in the United States. So we're at a very low ebb in terms of the actual ability to express dissident views in the United States.
Glenn Ford, I really appreciate the opportunity to hear from you again. Thanks for making the time to speak with our listeners.
No, thank you.
We've been speaking with Glenn Ford, commentator, broadcaster, and co-founder and executive editor of Black Agenda Report. He joined us from Plainfield, New Jersey. Mumia Abu-Jamal, considered by many to be America's most high-profile political prisoner, received good news in late 2018 when a Philadelphia Common Pleas Court judge ruled he could re-argue an appeal before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court on the grounds that then Chief Justice Ronald D. Castile had previously been involved in Mumia's case as Philadelphia District Attorney during a prior appeal and therefore should have recused himself. But on January 25th, that ruling was appealed by Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner, thereby delaying a possible vindication for Mumia by as much as a year. To take us through the latest wrinkles in the Mumia saga, we're joined by Suzanne Ross. She is the spokesperson for International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Could you comment on Judge Tucker's ruling last December? Was it in line with your expectations?
No, it was not in line with my expectations, nor most people's. And certainly not most Mumia supporters. And, you know, we've had such a long history of horrible judges, racist judges, you know, extremely biased against Mumia and so on and so on. And as Mumia put it, I thought he had the best comment. When he heard Judge Tucker's ruling, he said, "Well, that shows you what it's like when you don't have a lawyer that's been paid by the Fraternal Order of Police." Right after Krasner, the district attorney, the current district attorney, who was initially perceived as possibly, for some people, thought that he offered some hope for Mumia because he had a history of supporting many clients, having had clients who were in the Black Lives Matter movement, who had been in the Wall Street, in the Occupy Wall Street movement, and so on and so on, and he had promised, had campaigned that he would rule and revisit cases where there was unfair judgments. We expected, I mean, again, I don't speak for myself, lots of people expected that the DA was going to be a friend or at least more neutral than previous district attorneys, not out to get him. And lo and behold, when I sat in the courtroom, I was shocked, not because I expected, as I say, I myself was not expecting him to be kindly, but the intensity with which the district attorney's office, and it was not Krasner who was in the courtroom, it was a woman named Ms. Kavanaugh who argued so hard for Mumia's guilt and that he should not have a new opportunity for an appeal. And I, who had been around in 1995 and 1994 and through the case since then, when I sat in the courtroom and closed my eyes at one point, I thought to myself, this case, this performance sounds like that of the Fraternal of Police. There was no difference between the open Fraternal of Police representatives, who were the DAs of the 90s, 80s and 90s, and Krasner. They sounded the same. So lo and behold, here is this judge who's a Republican. He's a black judge and a Republican. Ends up shocking everyone, including me, when he rules that Mumia, Castile had not actually directly, there was no, he didn't say that wasn't involved in Mumia's case, but there was no evidence that they were able to find that showed that Castile was directly involved in Mumia's case at any point, which would automatically require that he would recuse himself. But that given that Castile had campaigned so hard for the death penalty, that he had, that Mumia was as famous as he was and surely could not have been overlooked by Castile, and that Castile was someone who campaigned so hard for the death penalty, and especially for so-called cop killers, that the fact that he was known and bragged about all these things when he campaigned for office as a judge, he bragged about those things, how many people he had sent to the death row, et cetera, et cetera. Given all that, the appearance, and this is his language, the appearance of bias is certainly in the picture. And that given that in a case that's this important and has such a long history, the appearance of bias is something that was not acceptable. You couldn't prove bias, but you could prove the appearance of bias. And based on that, he ruled that Mumia should have an appeal. The next day, Krasner report in a bizarre incident, in a bizarre event, says, gives out a report that he was looking for furniture among boxes of files and so on, and lo and behold, he came across six boxes that were clearly marked with Mumia's name on them, and also a former, somebody who had former worked in the district attorney's office, who was someone who was of the FOP bias. And this box had his name and Mumia's name on it, six boxes. Shocking, right? That had never been opened. And the judge immediately ruled that Mumia's lawyer should have access to those boxes. The day after Tucker's ruling, he makes this announcement. Krasner made, now, what is the district attorney doing looking for furniture in a storage room and suddenly finds these six boxes? You know, the whole thing was very fishy. Our Mumia's lawyers looked at those boxes. You know, they actually had a chance to review the material. And then on the 3rd of January, Krasner gives notice, announces that he's going to appeal Judge Tucker's ruling. In other words, so that's the timeline. And on the 25th, and then it turns out that another 100 boxes were found.
Mm.
And have to be evaluated. Now, all of that sounded very promising because we could not imagine that if you opened up those boxes, you wouldn't find in them, unless they had already destroyed that material, and, you know, at least something was likely to be in there that would show the conspiracy that we've been charging that has been going on in Philadelphia to execute Mumia, and ultimately to keep him on death row, to keep him in prison until he dies. And this is the punchline. Because Krasner is appealing Judge Tucker's decision, that process has to happen first. In other words, they can't even discuss what's in those boxes until they've had a complete review of the appeal that Krasner is making of Judge Tucker's ruling. So unfortunately, that could take a long time. Mumia was originally, when he was originally taken off death row, when a judge ruled originally that he never should have been sentenced to death, even if guilty, never should have been dead, he remained on death row for another 10 years after that judge made that ruling.
Yikes.
The legal system, the way it works, time delays, most of the time, work to the defendant's disadvantage, and in this case, to Mumia's disadvantage. So what Krasner did was horrendous. the Yale law students had done organized a conference on rebel lawyers, and he was seen as a rebel lawyer. And the minute other people heard of that, some Harvard students pushed the Yale students to disinvite him. The idea that here's someone who had just sold out and had done such damage to Mumia's case would now be honored was totally unacceptable, and he was successfully disinvited. And you have heard the message, which I hope you'll play for listeners, from Mumia that was read that night instead of Krasner's speech. And in Philadelphia, Krasner has now appeared at least four or five places in the last 2 weeks where he's been disrupted, where people have come with banners and signs saying, drop your appeal. Because the pressure has been, pressure on him from progressive people has been, drop the appeal of Judge Tucker's ruling. That's the concrete demand. And had he done that, and he still can do it, had he done that or still can do it, the whole picture would be completely different, and I would be sounding more optimistic than I am right now.
Okay. So there's still opportunities for the listenership to the general public to influence that?
Yes. Every Tuesday, there's a call-in to Krasner's office. I mean, you can call anytime, call, email, every Tuesday. But you can call, I say you don't have to do it on Tuesday, but there's an attempt to focus on that day. So that's happening all the time, and people are, like I say, Krasner cannot show up anywhere without somebody or other saying, what about Mumia?
That was Suzanne Ross, clinical psychologist and international spokesperson for International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. More details on Mumia's case can be found at the site freemumia.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Bipartisanship between neoliberals and conservatives built the monster we now call mass incarceration. No so-called progressive prosecutor can or will unbuild it. That's because it took the entire system, DAs, judges, cops, defense lawyers, and prison administrators, not to mention the media, to collaborate on a monstrous project like mass incarceration. Only mass resistance can abolish mass incarceration. In other words, only a mass movement.
We just heard an excerpt of a speech by Mumia Abu-Jamal played at the Rebellious Law Conference on Saturday, February 16th at Yale Law School. To listen to the entire 10-minute speech, please visit the site prisonradio.org and search for Rebel Lawyers Speech under Commentaries.
In Philadelphia, on August 8, 1978, in a pre-dawn raid, hundreds of Philadelphia police officers converged on the home of the Move family in the Powelton Village neighborhood. Battering rams and at least four high-pressure fire hoses were used against the occupants. During an exchange of gunfire which ensued, one Philadelphia police officer, James Ramp, was shot and killed. The Philadelphia court system found the nine adults in the communal household criminally responsible for the killing and charged them with third-degree murder. This in spite of the fact that ballistics revealed Ramp had been shot at a downward angle while the alleged perpetrators were in the basement of the house below Ramp. Last year, after spending four decades in prison, two of the Move 9 were released on parole, fully 10 years after being eligible. Debbie Africa was released in June, and her partner, Mike Africa Sr., released 4 months later. With two members having died while in prison, that leaves five still behind bars and prison walls for the crime that they have continually asserted they never committed. For the first time since their early 20s, Debbie and Mike Sr., now in their 60s, have been reunited with their children and grandchildren and can once again walk the streets freely. The Global Research News Hour welcomes Debbie, Mike Sr., and Mike Jr. to our program. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with our listeners.
You got it, man. On the move.
Debbie, Mike Sr., please, if you could you convey to our listeners the feelings that you experienced on having finally been released and being reunited with each other and with your kids and grandkids for the first time after 40 years behind prison walls?
Relief. I always tell the story that when I was first sent to prison in 1978, my oldest child was only 2 years. She wasn't even 2 years old yet. And Michael Jr. wasn't born yet. So I was pregnant with him. I had a two-year-old baby that was holding when the raid took place, and she was taken from me, and my daughter was taken from me. And without even realizing how long, I felt so heavy. When I finally got released, it was like a weight just came off of my heart. And that's really all I can explain. Like, as soon as I walked out that door, Michael Jr. was there and the family was there. His wife, his children, which are my grandchildren. It was just like the weight was just lifted up off of my heart. And it was just a really great feeling to know that, you know, they finally did something they were supposed to do, release us.
Yeah, well, for me, it was relief also. You know, it's a day that we had waited for, longed for all these decades, sometimes feeling that it wasn't even going to happen. And I did not believe that it was happening until even when we was granted parole. I still didn't believe it would happen until I was finally out that door on the road with my son in the car. At that point is when I finally believed that it had happened. And it was due all to a lot of hard work from Mike Jr. and a lot of family and a lot of friends, a lot of supporters. So I was euphoric, man. It was really, really nice.
And Mike Jr., maybe you'd like to comment on this day finally having arrived. I mean, sure, it's something you've dreamed about for, like, literally your entire life. Well, anything that you experienced that maybe you hadn't anticipated or expected?
It was the same thing for me. Trying to get something done and it not happening, you know, for a long time. So to actually finally get to that point and actually be able to, you know, watch my parents walk out of the prison and rather than be, you know, carried out or rather than be wheeled out. And that was a big thing. It was important. It was a relief for me, too.
Debbie and Mike, Senior, could you maybe just take us back to that raid in 1978? I mean, we've all heard the clinical account, but I was curious to know about the memories that have stuck with you from that day and that have haunted you in the decades since, you know, of what you saw and experienced on that horrible day.
Well, it was a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion. It was mostly just dark, because it was a lot of tear gas and smoke and shouting and babies crying and dogs barking. And it was a lot of confusion, man. And it was a horrible, horrible day. I just remember, you know, it was so dark you couldn't see anything in the basement. Because, as I said, it had shot in smoke and tear gas. So we couldn't breathe either, you know. And they had a lot of deluge hoses. And I don't know if you're familiar with those, but they were strong enough. The force of the water was strong enough to take bricks out of the wall. So, you know, you had to shield yourself from that. And so you didn't, you know, they were shooting from all, you know, all directions. Coming in at us. So it was just a terrible day, man. It was a miracle that we, you know, survived, that we came out of there. And then none of our children were killed. So It was just a hard day for us.
And Debbie, I mean, you, as I understand it, you were clutching your baby at the time. I mean, this is before Mike was born, but you know, maybe you have some recollections from that time as well.
Well, it was scary, that's for sure. It was scary. It was scary being pregnant and holding a baby and watching other women who had babies and young children. It was pretty scary. We're not really at liberty to talk about it at length because there's still litigation going on as far as the whole issue, you know, with that day. You know, it was also a tragic day for the officer who lost his life and moved never, ever, ever, ever willed nothing like that to happen. That not, there's never, ever been in our frame of mind, our frame of work, our frame of network, to have anything like that ever happen to anybody. Move Belief is about life, about protecting life. And that's what we're about. That's what our whole purpose is, to protect life, not to encourage life to be destroyed or killed. And so for me, all I can say is it was a really scary day, and I didn't think we were coming out of that house alive. I don't even know how we came out of that house alive, except for the fact that to say that it had to be a miracle.
Yes. Could you talk, both of you, about the time you spent in prison? It must have been particularly difficult, given that as MOVE members, you had a special diet and routines that were probably not compatible with what was being forced on you. What did you and your fellow incarcerated MOVE members have to put up with, and how did you cope for the past 40 years?
Well, we pretty much had to eat really what the prison served. And aside from being down in county for 3 years, myself and my other MOVE sisters who were down there, we had to eat what they served. However, we were able to obtain a few of the vegetables and fruits that we did normally eat on the street for those 3 years while we were in the county. But once we went upstate, we would just had to eat pretty much what everybody else had to eat. That, you know, and that's just the way it was. So the food wasn't the healthiest food to eat. You know, you hardly got any raw food at all, any vegetables. Everything was canned. And, you know, we didn't really have the option until years and years later, you know, of what you could eat. And even the commissary that you bought food or snacks from, the snacks weren't the healthiest to buy either, up until, like I said, like a few years maybe before I came home.
Well, prison, the conditions of prison are pretty well known, man, and we're not the only victims of a system that jails people who are innocent. You know, just recently another person was released from death row after doing 28 years by the current district attorney. And the food is historically horrible, you know, so these are well-known things. Not as well-known is the need for prison reform, which once we did settle in, we were always fighting for our freedom, always fighting to expose an unjust system. But what we settled in on is a lot of prison reform, a lot of things to expose and to help people gain their freedom and understand that while they might be working on their individual cases, there's a need to address a system that systemically represses certain people. And we worked hard to address those issues. And we did that even before we were jailed in the first place, which is another reason why we were attacked in the first place. So this is something that we're still continuing to do right now. You know, we are very much interested and active in the issue of prison reform.
And your interactions with other inmates, I mean, not, you know, people who you were also in prison, but like, were you able to interact with them and, you know, help continue the cause through your interactions with the people who were also in custody?
Yeah, very much so. And right now, you know, we still have people that, now, once they're released, they just had an issue with the juvenile vipers. And in Pennsylvania, in the United States, they had a ruling where if they found it unconstitutional for juvenile vipers to be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So many of them have been released over the last couple of years. And over the years, I had been in touch with many of them. We had all the Move people in prison had been in touch with a lot of them, mentoring them and keeping them out of, you know, some dire situations and protecting them from some dire situations. And they still come up to us to this day thanking us about those issues. So this is something that we continue to do now, mentoring people who's freshly released or and staying in contact with some of the people now.
I do have a story to tell about that, too. One day I was I was waiting for the bus to go someplace, and Michael Sr. was with me. When I got on the bus driver just kept looking, and he kept looking. He said, "I know that guy. I know that guy." He said, "Wow." He said, "Man, that's a strong brother." And he looked at me and he said, "Man, y'all are really strong people." And what he did was he recognized him from being released, and he recognized him from a friend of his telling him who he was and how he had taken care of his friend while he was in jail. And he just was in awe of just seeing him on the street because he remembered when he was released. And this is the kind of response that we're still getting on the street from people that mostly have been in there with Mike Sr. I mean, we were in the supermarket the other just about 2 weeks ago, and you know, the guy, a guy walked up to him and said, "Like, hey, you know, Mike, you know, just friendly and just always just so happy." And the first thing they say is, "Man, if it wasn't for you," he said, "Man, I would have been in some bad trouble. Like, you really kept me straight, you know." And these are the examples that we run into like all the time.
There's a question that's been burning in my mind, and I just have to ask you. You know, there's a saying that everyone who was alive at the time remembers where they were and what they were doing the day Kennedy was assassinated. Talk about that day in 1985 when you heard that the Move home on Osage Avenue had been fired on and bombed by the police, killing 11 of your family members, including 6 adults and 5 children, including your group's founder, John Africa. Could you share your feelings on that day, how you got the news, and how you processed that information?
I remember very well where I was at. Myself and the two Move women who had children in that house in 1985, we were all in solitary confinement at the time, 1985. We were all locked behind a gate. We were all in solitary confinement with only 1 hour out for recreation a day. And we were given the news by an officer who just came by each of ourselves and said, "There was a firebombing and your child is dead." That's the way we got the news. And in fact, let me think, it was 3 of them. It was Sue, Janine, and Janet, whose children were in that house May 13th, and that's how we got the news.
Well, for me, I was of Huntington Prison in 1985, and I was watching it unfold on either CNN or it had to be CNN, but it wasn't local up there. And I was just watching in disbelief, you know, and I didn't, I never believed what I was seeing, never believed that our people were actually gone. And until I talked to some people, some MOVE people later. Sometimes I had, I was left the TV set to call home, and I talked to a couple of the members of the organization, and they confirmed some things, and it was a very horrible, horrible, hard day.
Yeah, that's, it must have been quite horrible to have to get that news, and then, you know, you're continued incarceration goes on. Might I ask, how do you make sense of your release now, 40 years later and 10 years after being eligible for parole?
Well, the sense of it is that we should have never been, as you mentioned in your opening statement, that we should have never been convicted in the first place. That it took 40 years is, that's a system that needs reform. You know, that it should make more than MOVE people in sense. It should make more people than MOVE concerned about prison reform. That it does not speaks volumes of the system, not MOVE people. That we were speaking on it in the beginning, before August 8th, before May 20th, before any historical record about any confrontations between MOVE and the city of Philadelphia, should speak volumes about the MOVE organization, because we were aware of it before. We had stickers going on envelopes before. We were doing things in the community before this became a hot topic it is today. And thanks to MOVE's founder, John Africa, who got on this issue and stayed on this issue and warned people about this issue back then, that he encouraged MOVE people and opened the eyes of MOVE people and made people aware of it, and MOVE people committed themselves to this issue. So it's no surprise that it took 40 years. Some people, there are, you know, so many injustices in this system, man, about the things they do to people, the harm they cause to people. It's not just MOVE that are treated horribly like this. You know, so many things are not addressed in this system. You know, the child abuse, the child trafficking. There are so many missing people in the society. You have DACA. You have, you know, the environment that is treated so horribly and disdainfully. You have water. Remember the situation in Detroit you might have heard of there. In Michigan, where they were, you know, they had dirty water that they were trying, that they were saying was safe for children to drink. And, of course, it was dirty. You could see that it was dirty. And now all these children had brain damage and, you know, from lead poisoning. And they're still trying to, you know, wash their hands of that situation. So it's not surprising at all that they would treat one organization who speaks out against this in a horrible manner that they had, or that it took 40 years for them to correct a wrong that never should have been in the first place.
There have been, of course, a lot of changes in the world, in your city. What struck you the most about what's changed from the time you were jailed in 78 and what you're seeing around you now in 2019?
Well, what was I don't know if the word striking is the right word for it, but what was quite offensive to me, but not surprising to me, was the fact that we had to drink water out of a bottle and buy it. You know, something that's just so, should be supposedly, like the food used to be, free and abundance for all of life, all of humans, to be able to endure, is bottled up and sold for a profit. Something that you need in order to live. You cannot live without water. You cannot live without food. However, you know, we've lived in an environment, in a country, in a world that has prostituted the God-given food by nature for centuries. And so we're pretty much used to having to buy food. However, when you go back years and years ago and you read these books and even the Bible, you will see that you just go to a garden and pick food and eat it and survive. Well, that same mentality that caused man, the mentality of man, to take food from the earth that's given to us plentiful, that prostituted the earth and put it in a supermarket in order for us to have to buy it, it's a sin. And so, although we were used to that from growing up, you know, we just kind of accepted it, that you had to just buy food from a supermarket rather than just take it from the ground free. Well, when you come into the world now, and after 40 years, seeing that the water is actually bottled up and you have to buy it is equally, if not more, of a sin. And it's disturbing, because this is the way the system is going. This is the way humanity is going. And it is definitely a violation of our belief, and it's a violation of every God-given creature on this earth, because it shouldn't be that way. So that was the most obnoxious, you know, disturbing thing to me.
We know with technology comes more distortion and more imbalance and more imposition on the planet. And that's what we're seeing. You know, it's you can't go outside in the summertime without almost, you know, you're almost turning into the bubble boy. You know, you got to have some protection from life. And that's what, you know, all these so-called advances has caused on the planet. You know, everything is, you know, the Arctic looks like, you know, Florida, you know. So I'm not really concentrating on the changes. I'm concentrating on the things that the constants that remain the same. You know, the loyalty in people, the good in people, the activism in people, and the people who always take the chance and the time and the effort to speak out against the power that oppresses. No, I'm not concentrating on any of the changes, any of the new technology, you know, that they call advancement, because I know what the only thing that is advancing is a faster demise of the planet. So the things that are constant, you know, the love of my family, of people's families, and letting animals be animals and, you know, have their territories and, you know, just letting people be, man. Without restriction. And I'm concentrating on the hugs I get from my family. That's the thing that, you know, not the technology, not the advancement, you know, the love of my family. That's what I'm concentrating. And that's constant. It's the same 40 years ago as it is today.
I want to thank you for sharing with us. Is there, before we close, is there any message you have for our listeners who wish to show their solidarity with your cause and with the MOVE family. What do you like to say to them?
This is Mike Jr. For people that want to get involved and want to help out with what we're doing, you can go to my website as MikeAfricaJr.com, and at that website you can find links to the things that we're working on now. We started a nonprofit called the Seed of Wisdom Foundation, which we're working with people and young people and trying to get people to learn how to eat healthy and physical activity and all that kind of stuff. You can also find out more information about the MOVE organization and upcoming events and how to get involved and how to support. All the information that you need, you can go to MikeAfricaJr.com.
Okay. Well, Debbie, Mike Sr., Mike Jr., it's been a unique privilege to speak with you. I wish you all the best in your endeavors, and I believe you're doing a bit of touring. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us.